watching Chubbs come toward me. He knelt, one hand smoothing the tangled cloud of hair off my face. We listened to the wheels churn up the loose gravel of the driveway, both of us still and silent.
"I'm sorry," Chubbs said finally. "Are you okay? Did he dislocate your shoulder? Because if he did..."
"I'm all right," I said, but could you please cut the zip ties off now?" I was horrified by the way my voice shook. But in addition to the discomfort, my brain was starting to spark up old memories that were better left buried deep. The bus ride into Thurmond. The sorting. Sam. The minute I heard the plastic snap under his knife, I was pushing myself up onto my knees, ignoring the ache in my right shoulder. Chubbs began to reach over to check on it, but I leaned back, just out of his reach. We sat there, staring at each other, letting the space between us fill with rain and silence. Finally, I held out my hand, and without a word, he pressed the black booklet into it. The cover was a tough faux leather, and I hadn't necessarily been wrong in thinking that it was a passport. At first glance, it looked exactly the same, from the faint blue paper and the iridescent United States of America seal overlaying it. Fugitive Psi Recovery Agent. God, there was an official title for it? "Joseph Lister," I read. "Age 24, 6 feet, 170 pounds from Penn Hills, Pennsylvania." I glanced over at him. He was wearing an identical scowl to the one in his official photograph. "You know, it's funny. The least believable thing about all that is your weight." "Oh, hilarious," he groused, snatching it back from me before I could skim through the other pages. It was so Chubbs, so the Chubbs I knew, that I smiled. He struggled to keep his lips pressed in a stern line, but I saw the beginnings of a curve. "I really thought you were dead," I said quietly. "I shouldn't have let them take you." He brought a hand up to his shoulder, pressing it there, as if his mind was cycling back to that moment, too.
"You pushed the panic button, right?"
I nodded.
"I would have done the same thing," he said. "The exact same thing. Well..."
He stopped, actually considering this.
"I probably would have been a little steadier in applying pressure to the wound, but other than that, yes."
"Well, you'll want to stop now," I told him dryly, "before you ruin our touching moment." The window above us suddenly opened, and Jude's curling mass of hair appeared there.
"Rue, are you okay? Oh my God, Vida wouldn't let me watch, but I tried to go around front, but the doors are all boarded up and there's nothing in here, so I just..."
Chubbs helped me up, giving me a look that clearly asked, "What fresh hell is this?" "I'll tell you everything later, and you're going to do the exact same, but for now, we have to see if we can find some kind of clue about what direction Lee might have headed." Chubbs's brow drew together as he lowered his voice.
"Didn't Lee tell you the procedure he and Harry set up to make contact?"
"I knew he had one, just not what it was," I said.
"But he told you?"
He nodded, shifting so his back was facing the window, and, I realized, the people inside.
"We need to go. Now."
"Wait," I began, but he already had his arm looped through mine.
"They're watching the house. We have to go," he said. "And I'm sorry, I'd much rather not have the League riding with us."
I detangled my arm from his, taking a step back. "I can't leave them."
"You are not League," he insisted. "You are not one of them. You're one of us."
"Don't think about it as us and them," I pleaded. "We can all work together on this for now. You don't have to come back with us to California after we find Liam. You just have to stay with us now." Out of the corner of my eye, I caught Vida's electric blue hair through the window screen. "Back then, you didn't want me to stay either, remember?"
"Yeah.
But that was different," he said, his voice low,
"and you know it."
"But at the time, you didn't know that." I had read him right. I saw it in his face, in the rigid lines of his tight shoulders. "You asked me if I trusted you," I whispered. "Do you trust me?" He blew out a long breath, his hands resting on his hips.
God help me, he said finally. I do, but I trust you, not them. I don't even know who they are.
I only held out my hand and waited for him to take it. I needed his long fingers to close around mine, wanted that final proof that his better sense and reasoning had given way to the belief he used to have in me. I waited for him to come with me, to accept that we were now in this together again, that time and distance and uncertainty hadn't been enough to shake us. And he did. 10. The tan SUV reeked of fake evergreens. The smell of the air freshener was so overpowering I had to roll down my windows to get fresh air circulating.
You wouldn't be complaining if you were there to smell the guy I bought it off of, Chubb said, handing me a pair of sunglasses to wear. Now, put your seatbelt on, please.
Vida and Jude were already buckled into the back seat, though they hadn't gone quietly. My favorite team member got one look at the metal grating that separated the front seats from the back and just about ripped my hair out at the roots trying to yank me out of the front seat.
Are we driving this slowly because you have no idea where we're going? Vida asked. Or because you're hoping we jump out of the car and put ourselves out of our misery?
Jude sat straight up, alarmed. We both recognized that tone. Vida picked fights when she was bored, and battles when she was stressed. If it were the latter, only one of them was going to make it out of this car ride alive. We'd be washing the blood off the windows for weeks.
That'd be doing the psychos holding your leashes a favor.
For the first time, I was grateful for the metal grating between us.
They're not psychos, you condescending dick, she snarled.
I'm condescending? Chubbs asked. Do you even know what that word means?
You piece of flaming so,
Jude said, his voice high.
Rue, how do you and Chubbs know each other?
Charles, he gritted out. My name is Charles.
That's supposed to be better? Vida scoffed.
Chubbs let the car roll to a stop at a red light and turned to look at me, fire burning behind the lenses of his glasses.
Yep, I said. She's always like this.
The tension that welled up in the car hovered among us, strung tight. One word or wrong move would snap it. Jude drummed his fingers against the armrest.
Cut that shit out, Nimrod, before I cut them off, Vida said.
Nimrod, he shot back, his voice jumping an octave with outrage.
You don't have to be so mean, you know?
I pressed a hand to my forehead. That gets you upset? That dumb name? She's been calling you Judith for months. Chubbs laughed, but turned it into a cough when he saw my look.
Yeah, well,
Jude huffed, drawing his bony knees up to his chest.
I guess I just don't see what's so insulting about being called a girl. The two of you seem to do okay when you're not biting my head off or acting like I'm 5 years old.
As opposed to what?
Chubbs said, flicking on the turn signal to merge onto a highway.
The 10-year-old you actually are?
Hey, I warned, none of that. He's almost 15.
Rue?
Jude began, his eyes shining.
Thank you.
You were that gawky when I first met you, I continued, poking Chubbs in the shoulder, and you were 18.
Never mind, Jude grumbled. You were the gawky one, he corrected. Lee was the reckless one, Zoo was the cute one, and I was the wise one.
There was a knock on the grate behind us. Jude's face was floating there, his dark brown eyes peering between the two of us from behind the metal screen.
It would be nice, he said, if we had any idea what you guys are talking about. Like, who this Zoo person is?
Chubbs' eyes slid over to mine.
Exactly how much did you tell them?
Exactly nothing, Vida said. And if it stays that way, I will make you regret it.
This time I rolled my eyes. Sure, whatever you say. I felt the familiar warm tingling at the center of my chest and had just enough time to gasp as some invisible hand yanked me forward, smacking my forehead against the dashboard with enough force to stun me dumb. Chubb slammed on the brakes, forcing my seatbelt to do its job and lock against my chest. I was thrown back into my seat, an explosion of colors bursting in my vision.
"Oh, hell no!"
Chubbs roared, slamming a hand against the steering wheel.
"That's it! We do not use our abilities on one another, goddammit! Behave yourself!"
"Chill the fuck out, Granny," Vida said. "You're going to give yourself a stroke."
"You cannot give yourself..."
Chubbs began in a growl, but caught himself. Jude let out a nervous laugh behind us, but I only pressed a hand to my stinging forehead. She had made her point. "Zoo was a friend of ours," I said. "We traveled together for a while."
"I thought Kate got you out, though," Jude said. "Did you guys get separated or something? It seems like it would be dangerous just to be out wandering around."
"It wasn't like that," Chubbs said. "After the three of us broke out of the camp..."
He might as well have told the others that he was a wizard. Even Vida leaned forward, suddenly so much more interested.
"You," she began. "You broke out of a camp."
"Liam planned it," Chubbs gritted out. "But yes, I did."
"Does that kid think he's some kind of expert in getaways?" Vida muttered. "God damn."
Jude's eyes were bright with interest.
"What was that like? Did you have your own room? Like a little prison cell? Did they make you do hard labor?"
"I heard that..." The kids in the league knew about the camps, vaguely. There were only a few of us who had actually lived in one and experienced the life firsthand. But there was an unspoken rule we didn't talk about it. Everyone knew the truth, but the truth didn't live inside them the way it did for us. They'd heard about the sorting machines, the cabins, the testing, but most of their stories were gossip, completely wrong. These kids had never stood for hours on end in an assembly line. They didn't know fear came in the shape of a small black camera lens, an eye that followed you everywhere, at all times. My chest tightened with the effort of keeping silent. One by one, my fingers closed around the seatbelt's silver fabric until I was all but choking it.
"Do you not remember it or something?" Jude asked. "Were you only there for a little while? Is that why you can't talk about it, because there's nothing to say?"
"I would shut your mouth," Chubbs advised.
"Come on," Jude whined. "If she'd just talked to us."
"What?"
The word exploded out of me.
"What do you want me to tell you? You want to hear about how they tied us up like animals to bring us into the camp? Or, hey, how about that time a PSF once beat a girl's skull so badly, she actually lost an eye? You want to know what it was like to drink rotten water for an entire summer until new pipes finally came? How I woke up afraid and went to bed in terror every single day for 6 years? For God's sake! Leave me alone! Why do you always have to dig and dig when you know I don't want to talk about it?"
I regretted the outburst halfway through, but the speech tumbled out, one vile, traitorous word after another. Chubbs only glanced at the glowing blue clock, then back up at the soggy road. In the back seat, Jude was as silent as snow falling on asphalt, his mouth opening and closing like he was trying to taste the burn of his words after they left his lips.
"I don't know about the rest of you, but I'd be up for hearing about the one-eyed chick," Vida said with a shrug.
"You are actually the worst person I have ever met," Chubb said.
"And people like you are the reason we have middle fingers."
"Guys," I started. Kate had told me once, a long time ago, that the only way to survive your past was to find a way to close it off behind you, to shut one door before passing into another, brighter room. I was afraid. That was the truth. I was terrified of the guilt and shame that would come flooding in when I retraced my steps, turned the lock, and found the girl I had abandoned. I didn't want to know what the darkness there had done to her, if she would even recognize herself in my face. I didn't want to know what Chubbs would think of me after he found out what I'd done for the league. I didn't want to know what Liam would think of me, or of the smell of smoke in my hair that never went away, no matter how many times I washed it.
At least tell us about how you ended up splitting with Liam, Jude said. If you guys were traveling together, why did you, stop? Kate came to get you when you pushed the panic button, I know, but was Liam gone by then? What about him? He pointed at Chubbs. Those memories weren't any less painful, but they were important. All right, I said. You know that we traveled together, Liam, Chubbs, Zoo, and me. But what you don't know is that we were looking for a place, a safe haven called East River. To understand why I did it and how he ended up on his own, I have to start there. Fine, Vida answered, leaning back away from the grating, her eyes drifting over to the window at her right. The first traces of snow drifted into our roaring path. I told them about East River, how it had felt like a dream until we woke up and realized we were trapped in a nightmare, about Clancy, which was so much harder than even I expected, how we escaped, how Chubbs was shot, and how it was just the two of us in the safe house. Jude started to interrupt, his eyes wide with either anxiety or confusion I couldn't tell. I felt my own heart drift up and up and up until I had to swallow it down to get through what came next. My decision and Kate's deal. What I had seen in Cole's memory and his own explanation of it. In the strangest way, it made me feel closer to Liam. He was alive and vivid in my thoughts. Solid, warm Liam, with his sunglasses on, the sunlight in his hair, and the words of a favorite song on his lips. I half expected to look up and see him in the driver's seat. No one spoke. I couldn't bring myself to look behind me. I felt both Jude's and Vida's conflicted feelings cling to my skin, the way condensation was gathering on the windows. I felt a light touch on my shoulder. I turned, slowly, to see Jude retract his finger back through the metal grate. His bottom lip was white where it was caught between his teeth. But he was looking at me, not with fear or any of its ugly cousins, just a deep, sincere sadness. He could still stand to look at me. "Rue," Jude whispered, "I'm so sorry."
"Can I just ask one thing?" Chubb said, his voice sounding tight in his throat after I finished. "What are you doing with the flash drive?"
"I was going to bring it back to Cole," I said. "He and I have a deal. If I get the intel back to him, it'll be enough to shift the priorities of the League back to freeing kids from camps and exposing the government's lies." Chubbs rubbed his forehead.
"And you believe him? The only thing Liam ever said about him was that he used to set his toys on fire when he didn't get his way."
"I believe him," I said. "He won't hurt us. He's one of the few who doesn't want us gone, apparently."
"Gone?" Chubbs asked, alarmed.
I let Jude explain. His stumbling, rambling explanation was coated by rough grief, and it made the story that much more horrible to hear.
No, Chubbs said. "You're just going back, hoping they manage to pick out all of the bad seeds?"
"Don't say it like that," Jude cried. "It'll get better. Rob's gone, right? Kate will let us know when we can come back."
"You and Liam will be safe, at least from the League," I told Chubbs. "They won't come after you. You get it, right? You understand why I told Cole I'd do this."
"Sure. I get it,"
he said, his voice cold enough to drive a chill through even my veins. And again, I read the question he was really asking in the silence he left to fill the space between us. I knew what he wanted to ask, because it was the same thought that had been circling in on me for days. If the intel is that important, why would you ever give it to the League? Of all the training and ops and the League-sponsored explosions I'd been unfortunate enough to witness, none seemed half as dramatic as Chubbs's thrilling tale of escape. We pulled into an old camping ground for the night, just outside of a city called Asheville in western North Carolina. I'd managed to fill most of the 5-hour drive with explanations, and the whole thing had left me drained,
I didn't put up any kind of struggle when Chubbs and Jude argued for stopping. We did a quick walkthrough of the area to make sure it was clear of other visitors before returning to pull supplies from the SUV. I popped the latch, stepping back from the door as it opened.
Oh my God,
I managed. The whole thing was just so impressive. A wall of small stacked plastic tubs and drawers, all labeled with handy reminders like first aid and rope and vitamins and fishing hooks. The care and forethought it had taken to put this all together was impressive, if not completely terrifying in how ruthlessly thorough it was. Jude gave Chubbs a long look of appraisal.
You had day-of-the-week underwear growing up, didn't you?
Chubbs merely pushed the glasses up the bridge of his nose.
I don't see how that's any of your business.
He laid out the entire story for me as we set up the tent that had been folded neatly under the back seat. Vida, at least, was able to get a small fire going with a lighter.
I don't actually remember most of this stuff happening, Chubbs said, struggling with the tent's frame. The League brought me to the nearest hospital, which happened to be the one in Alexandria.
Not Fairfax? I asked, smoothing the damp hair away from my face. Jude and Vida were doing their best to listen to all of this while pretending they weren't. Chubbs shrugged.
I have a vague memory of seeing some faces, but... I told you that I look like my dad, right?
I nodded.
Well, one of the doctors recognized me. She used to work with Dad, but transferred. Anyway, it's not important. They managed to stabilize me, but this doctor and her staff knew I needed to be in a better-equipped hospital. So she got on the phone and tracked Dad down. He was going to meet us at my aunt's restaurant, remember?
I remember.
He was able to meet the ambulance when it arrived at Fairfax Hospital. They already had a fake ID prepared for me, so that's what they registered me under. They kept an oxygen mask on my face the entire time. I got walked through two sets of security guards, and no one looked twice.
And they didn't tell the agents who brought you in? I finished. The League has no idea what happened to you. You're still listed as MIA in all of the related op files.
Chubbs snorted. They tried telling the agents I coded out and died, but they didn't bite. One day, my dad had six different people come to him fishing for information, but they didn't get a word out of him.
The real trick hadn't been admitting him at the new hospital under a false name. The hospital had become well-versed in a don't-ask-we-won't-tell policy when it came to dealing with the government and their requests for information, so much so that they were nearly shut down a good half-dozen times. Dr. Merriweather's stroke of genius was to hide his son, Marcus Bell, in an isolated room in the maternity ward for treatment. When he was strong enough, he was zipped up in a body bag and taken out of the hospital in a rented hearse. The League agents found the transfer paperwork and tried to connect the dots, but Chubbs became a ghost the moment he had been wheeled into Fairfax Hospital. From there, it had been a matter of finding a place for Chubbs to recuperate and build his strength back up again.
I will leave it to you to imagine what it was like to live in a ramshackle barn in upstate New York for 4 months. He said, grimacing as he rolled his shoulder back. I will go to my grave, smelling hay and manure every time I close my eyes.
The old barn belonged to a close family friend in the Adirondacks, and it had been isolated, cold, and lonely by the sound of it. His parents could only come up twice to see him without sparking suspicion, but the elderly woman who owned the farm was there twice a day to help with his physical therapy and provide food. Mostly, though, he was bored to tears.
I like to think I get along pretty well with the elderly, but this woman looked like she dragged herself up from the crypt every morning.
Yeah, to feed and nurse you, I reminded him.
The only books she had were about a crime-solving spinster bothering people in her small village, he said. I'm allowed to be a little bitter about the experience.
No, I said. Actually, I'm pretty sure you're not.
How did you end up doing all of this, though? Jude asked.
Chubbs sighed.
I actually have to give Mrs. Berkshire credit. It was something she said after I told her about how I got out of Virginia. that the last place people tend to look for the hunted is among the hunters. She fell asleep mid-sentence, of course. I had to wait 4 hours to be blessed with the second half of her old lady mysticism. I pressed a hand over my eyes. "I'll have you know I haven't been suspected once," he said, a bit too pleased with himself. "My parents got the doctored birth papers, which was the hardest part. It's actually not that difficult to be registered as an official skip tracer. You just have to provide the right paperwork and establish yourself." The fire popped loudly, collapsing the small pile of wood we'd gathered. It seemed to be the right place to take a break in the story. I stood and pulled Chubbs up off the ground to come with me. Jude started to rise, but I waved him back. "We're just going to get some food," I said. "We'll be right back."
"Don't worry,"
Vida said in her sugary sweet voice. She wrapped an arm around Jude's shoulders.
"We have been known to survive 2 whole minutes without you."
I tried very hard not to stomp over to the car. "I really do not trust that girl," Chubbs said, glancing back over his shoulder where Vida was still sitting, her legs stretched out in front of her. "Youths who dye their hair are always battling inferiority complexes or hiding secrets." I raised an eyebrow. "Youths?" He was so focused on her that he almost whacked himself in the face with the rear door of the SUV. Chubbs' hand flew to his left shoulder, as if to protect it.
"Let me see it,"
I said, stopping him before he could reach for the tub labeled protein bars. He sighed and slipped that arm from its jacket sleeve. There was enough stretch in his shirt's fabric for him to pull the collar down across his left shoulder, where a quarter-sized patch of pink, puckered skin stood out stark against his otherwise dark skin.
"Did they..."
My throat suddenly felt dry.
"Did they get it out? The bullet?"
He adjusted his shirt, smoothing it back down again. "It was a clean shot. It went straight through. As far as bullet wounds go, it wasn't anything awful."
It wasn't anything awful.
I swallowed, a weak attempt to keep from crying.
"Oh, geez, not again," he said. "I'm fine. I'm alive, right?"
"Why did you come back?" I whispered, hearing my own voice break. "Why didn't you stay up there, where it was safe?" Chubbs, food cradled against his chest, reached one long arm up to close the door.
"And leave you two idiots out on the run?"
I watched him heave in 2 deep breaths, then send them sailing out in a long white cloud.
"I'm so angry with you,"
he said finally, his voice low.
"I'm furious. I know why you erased yourself, I understand. But all I want to do is shake some sense back into you."
"I know," I said. "I know, okay?"
"Do you, though?" he asked. "You won't leave these two, even though they could report me, and Lee, back to the League. You put yourself in the line of fire with the worst people, and you did it without someone there to watch your back. How do you think Lee's going to react when he finds out what you did?"
The knot in my stomach tightened to the point of pain. He was furious. The strength of the anger powering him was like a beacon to my mind. It made him vulnerable, exposed.
"He won't find out," I said. "I told you all I was going to do was get the flash drive and make sure he was all right. I wasn't going to... I'm not going to interfere."
"That is the most bullshit, cowardly thing I have ever heard come out of your mouth," he shot back. "You lied to us before about what you are, and I got it. I understand why you did it. But now, you're out, and we can all be together again. And you're choosing the only option that ends with us apart? Maybe Liam could forgive you for what you did. But if you go back to them, to California, I will never forgive you." He started to turn back to the fire and dark green tent, only to pivot back to me.
"Do you remember what it felt like when East River was attacked and we hid in that lake? All that night, I kept thinking, well, this is the worst thing that will ever happen to me. I thought the same thing when we escaped Caledonia
and we had to leave the other guys in our cabin behind, bleeding to death in the snow. And again, when I was shot. But the thing is, I was wrong. Ruby, the worst thing, was being safe up in that barn and not knowing for 6 months what happened to you and Liam and Suzume. It was seeing your names pop up on the Skip Tracer networks with upped rewards and potential sightings and not being able to find any of you for months. Sometimes, most of the time with Chubbs, really, it was impossible to tell his anger from his fear. They fed into each other. Then, all of a sudden, you were showing up everywhere, in Boston, in a train station in Rhode Island. You were being really careless there, you know? He shot me a disapproving look. Liam's even worse. For months, nothing. Then a tip about him being sighted in Philadelphia. I had to doctor evidence that the tip was bad to get it deleted off the network. The League had backdoor access to both the PSF and Skip Tracer databases of kids, but neither of Liam's profiles looked like they had been updated in ages. I knew. I checked twice a week. No wonder it looked like it hadn't been updated the last time I looked. How did you know to go to his house? I asked. The timing couldn't have been a coincidence. I figured it had to be something to do with the protocol Harry set up to help them find each other. Based on the sightings, I thought maybe the two of you were coming down to his old house to check to see if his stepdad set up the procedure. Which was what? When Cole and Liam left to join the League, Harry told them that if he and their mom felt like they needed to get out, he'd leave coordinates under the windowsill of Liam's old bedroom. "And you have the coordinates?" I asked. "No," he said. "There was nothing there." That must be why he went to find Cole in Philadelphia, to see if he knew anything. Chubbs rubbed a knuckle over his lips, nodding. "That's what I'm thinking, too. It doesn't help us, though, if Cole had no idea either."
"I know," I said. "Running blind, just like old times."
Chubbs sighed, and I swayed toward him, resting my forehead against his upper arm. "We'll watch the Skip Tracer network. See if there are any other sightings." Chubbs shifted, hiking the cans up against his chest. "He's screwed up a few times in the past. Chances are he'll do it again." It was a terrifying thought. We might pick up hints of him here and there, but chances were we'd be too far away to swoop in and help if he were captured. He had a big enough head start on us that he could put some real distance behind him, and it was overwhelming to know that. Suddenly, everything seemed so much harder and more impossible than only a few minutes before. It all felt so pointless. "I'm so tired of this," I told him. "I know I don't have any right to be. I know I did this to us, to myself. But I don't want to fight anymore. I'm so tired of everything, of all of this, and knowing it's never going to get any better, that nothing I do will ever make anything better. I'm so sick of it all." Chubbs shifted the cans in his arms, ducking down to get a closer look at my face. I wasn't crying, but my throat ached and my head was pounding.
"No, what you are is exhausted," he said. "Depression, anxiety, difficulty focusing. You're a classic case. Come on, you'll feel better after you get food and some sleep."
"That won't solve anything either."
"I know," he said. "But it's a start."
I learned a long time ago that it was possible to be so far past the point of exhaustion that sleep no longer felt like an option. My stomach ached with the need for it, and my head felt heavy, but I could feel myself waiting for something, muscles tense and brain unable to settle. It was like no matter how hard I fought to focus on the point of the tense roof, to count off sheep, my mind kept drifting back to the night we had spent in the abandoned Walmart, to the kids we had been so convinced were going to screw us over in the worst way. I must have nodded off at some point, because the next thing I knew, I was startled awake by a cold blast of air. Vida was at the opening of the tent, unzipping it slowly and as quietly as she could and stepping through. My head was slow to come up out of the fog of sleep, but I was alert enough to be suspicious. No matter how much I wanted to drift back into dreamland.
I counted to 30, to 60. I listened as her footsteps grew softer, watched, waiting for her to come back. She didn't. What are you up to? I thought, crawling over Chubb's long legs to the tent's opening. If she had needed to get a breath of fresh air or relieve herself, she would have been back by now. Despite the crippling dark, I spotted her right away. She was shivering, rubbing her arms to try to shake off the night's icy grip. I saw her glance back toward the tent once, and pulled back, hoping the moon wasn't bright enough for her to make out my shape behind the tent's thin, waterproof covering. Vida slinked her way around Chubbs's tan Ford Explorer, circling it twice before coming to stop by the driver's side. "Sucks to be you," I thought, feeling a little smugger than was probably necessary. I had reminded Chubbs to lock it, and with the gun inside the glove box, she'd have to find a rock or something heavy enough to break the glass if she wanted in, something that would be difficult to manage quietly. If it hadn't been for her bright hair, I would have lost her in the darkness as she headed off the trail into the forest. I stood and slipped out, tracing her steps around the car, trying to see how far she'd go. My toes were frozen stiff, sticking to the frost of the clumps of wild grass and mud. Vida kept walking, and I kept inching forward, more and more, until she was far enough for her hair to disappear into the night-cloaked trees completely, but not far enough to hide the blue-white glow of the device in her hand that cut through the darkness. 11. Wait for her to come back, my mind reasoned. Surprise her here. But I was running, even before the thought had fully formed in my mind. All of the training the League had tried to drill into me, all of my better judgment, all logic, was ripped away with the first flash of that strange light. If she were contacting Cole, why would she have to hide it from us? Why would she need to send a message to him in private? Because she's not contacting Cole. I slid around the car. The coming winter had stripped the nearby trees bare. The naked branches snapped against my face and arms. The fine patches of ice and frost coating the clumps of grass stung my feet like hell, but it was nothing compared to fighting my way through the thickets of dead brush. It didn't matter how much noise I was making. I wasn't aiming for surprise. It was impossible to get the jump on Vida. I just wanted as much momentum as humanly possible when I tackled her to the ground. She was still clutching the device when I lowered my head and rammed my shoulder into her. Vida had enough time to try to swing a knee up, square into my chest. With my full weight on her, and only one foot planted on the uneven hill, we slammed into the ground. I hooked my leg around hers, and she reached up to get a good grip on my neck, and neither of us was willing to let go. Even as we rolled down the slope, smashing through underbrush and nailing what was very likely every single rock on the damn mountain, we didn't stop. We couldn't. Not until we crashed into a tree and sent a shower of dead brown leaves down over us. My vision swam, both from the spinning and the blows, but I was on top. I had the advantage, and I took it. A warm burst of Vida's breath clouded the air. I had my legs locked around her center, trying to keep her in place as I started to reach for the black device lying beside her neck. Never in my life had I seen terror like that in Vida's eyes. She reared up under me, freeing her arm from where it was pinned beneath her, and slapped me hard enough that, for a second, my vision blanked white. With a grunt, she swung her open palm again, clubbing me in the ear and effectively knocking me off her. Vida had jumped to her feet, and I staggered up after her. My sight split in two, and I wasn't sure which one of her feet was actually flying toward my stomach until it made contact. I threw my arms up in front of my face to block the next one. "How could you?" I gasped out. My fingers caught her wrist, but she ripped it free. I swung my fist toward her again and watched, stunned, as she went flying back through the air a good 24 feet before I could even touch her. Stop! I panted hard and was only able to keep on my feet for one more second. I sagged sideways into the rough embrace of a tree and slid all the way down onto my knees. The words were faint under the roar of blood pulsing in my ears. I turned, watching as Jude stumbled down the slope,
tripping through the dense cluster of branches and soggy leaves until he dropped to his knees at Vida's side. Chubb stood a short distance away, his arms still outstretched in the direction he had thrown her.
What? He called. The hell is going on?
She... I sputtered, bringing a shaking hand to swipe at my mouth. He marched toward me, flicking his flashlight in my direction.
She had... device... calling DC...
When he finally reached me, he grabbed my arm. I squirmed away from the intense light he was trying to shine directly into my face. I lurched away from him, the ground rising up to meet me.
Do you see it?
I heard myself asking.
Do you see it? Give me the light!
Ask her! Vida was shouting. She attacked me!
Chubbs dutifully aimed the flashlight where I pointed.
You need to sit down. Hey, are you even listening to me?
I padded around the dirt, fingers groping through the mulch, rocks, and roots. I knew the moment I had found it. The black shell was unnaturally smooth and still warm to the touch. During the fight, the screen had flipped down to the ground, stifling the glow.
What is that?
Chubbs crouched down next to me.
A phone?
Close, but not quite.
A chatter? Came Jude's startled voice. Where did you get that?
He was standing behind us, supporting a swaying Vida. No, he wasn't supporting her. He had one arm across her chest to keep her from going at my throat. Dumb, brave kid, I thought for the thousandth time. I turned my eyes back down on the screen and flicked it on. I had interrupted her in the middle of typing a message.
Good.
I brought the screen up close to my eyes, squinting at the series of nonsense numbers and letters. The little black line was still blinking, waiting for her to finish up. I have them. Phase 2, INSTR, LWJERL, KSSLKJDFJ.
You bitch, I said, looking up. You really thought you could play us? Turn us back over to the League? What did Albin promise you? That you could take over as team leader?
I was half blind with rage, too angry to let her answer. I stood, throwing the device on the ground. Vida and Jude both took generous steps back. My brain was humming with need, with nothing more than the desire to pry into hers and leave it mangled and ruined. My anger added a boost to their strength, and I thought, I really did. If I let them loose, the invisible hands would take her this time, without me needing to grab her. I turned, ready to let them fly. Instead, I felt a hand close over my wrist and pull me back. Chubbs was on his feet now, too, his eyes fixed on the screen. I heard him click a button, and then the chatter was hovering in front of my face, and I was reading an old, received message. Head south on 40. Address as discussed. Explain updated op immediately upon contact. Tell her I am sorry.
Tell her I'm sorry?
I turned back toward Vida, who had turned away, her face a stone mask.
Who is this, Cole?
Vida's swollen lips slurred her speech, and when she spoke it was so quiet I had to strain to hear her. Her reluctance proved the blossoming theory in my mind. After all, there was only one person she protected like this.
No, she said. It's Kate.
I was ready to have it all out there, but Chubbs insisted that we return to the camp and rebuild the fire, with a sharp, I prefer not to take my bad news in the freezing dead of night, thank you very much. He steered me toward one end of the smothered fire and headed for his car. I was distantly aware of the beep of the car unlocking and the door slamming shut. When he sat back down next to me, Chubbs started in on cleaning the cuts on my face and arms with a total lack of sympathy.
Someone better start talking now, he said, because, trust me, you don't want to hear what I have to say about all this, especially at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Vida sniffed, drawing her knees up to her chest. The right half of her face was cast entirely in darkness, or covered in an enormous bruise. I held up the chatter to the dim firelight, turning it back and forth.
Who gave you this? Nico? She waited so long to answer, I thought for sure she wouldn't. All I got was a shrug. Her nails were clawing into the dirt, dragging clumps of it up into her clenched fists. So he and Kate are in on this too? I demanded. Who else? Vida crossed her arms over her chest and stared out into the dark distance.
Why keep this from us? Jude asked. Did she ask you to?
It doesn't make any sense, and it really doesn't make sense that you still won't talk about it. You got caught, and now the op has been compromised. And what are you supposed to do when that happens?
Accept, adapt, and act. Quickly. The words had been scrawled onto one of the walls in the training room. They might as well have been tattooed directly onto our brains.
Fine,
she said, circling her shoulders back as if to ease the tension there. She's angry, I realized. Vida was furious, with herself. The perfect little soldier had blown her own op, the special one Kate had entrusted her with. She was breathing hard, sucking air up between her clenched teeth. Kate was the single most important person in her life, maybe the only one who really mattered to her. I had an idea of why she had withheld that information, but I wanted to hear her admit it.
Kate and Cole planned this whole thing, pretty much from the second we brought his ass back to HQ, Vida said. They go back. She took him under her wing when he first joined, helped train him. He told her the truth about your dumbass Prince Charming and the flash drive, and you were the solution they came up with. For whatever reason, Kate stupidly trusts you to handle shit.
Why have Cole give me the story, then?
They're watching her, Rob and the others. She knew what he was like, or at least figured it out a few months ago, but she was trying to stay close to his creepy ass to make sure he didn't come after us. She couldn't go to Albin or any of the advisors because she was afraid she'd be reassigned from us if they saw her as being difficult. Nico showed Cole, Kate, and me the video of Blake being offed, and she just about went ballistic.
When was this?
Just after you left HQ?
Vida tucked a strand of hair behind her ear, glancing over at me.
Nico said you told him not to, but something you said to Cole made him push the issue. They're sitting on the video until we bring the intel back.
Of course, because keeping the Children's League together was the top priority here. Not protecting kids. Not cutting off the psychopaths.
Let me see if I understand this, Chubbs began. Kate was in on everything from the beginning, but she kept silent on it. Was that to act as some kind of failsafe?
Not bad, Granny, Vida said. Cole said Kate's role had to stay a secret, even from you. If you dipshits got caught and were brought in for questioning, he didn't want you to be able to implicate her. If he took the fall, at least Kate would still be around to be on our side. She hated it, but I told her she had to agree, otherwise I wasn't going to help you. She didn't say yes until she realized there was no way to get Jude removed from the mission without it making people suspicious. Rob requested him personally.
Jude looked like he was a breath away from throwing up all over himself. The firelight drew out the flush of panic in his cheeks. Vida threw a truly pitying look his way.
Kate said he ran after you called him out, went totally off the fucking grid before Barton could bring him in for questioning.
So, he won't be there when we get back, Jude said, sighing in relief.
No. But it meant that I had released a furious monster out into the world to rip it apart and remake it to his own liking.
That's everything I know, Vida said.
The end. But I'm telling you now, if either of you breathe a word, one goddamn word, about Kate, I will come down on you so hard they'll be naming hurricanes after me for a fucking century.
I opened my mouth to fire back at her, but thought better of it in the end. For as long as I'd known Vida, I'd felt a sharp sense of pity over her obvious worship of Kate. I thought I'd been given a glimpse of the real Kate that lived below the pristine exterior. But now it was becoming harder and harder to believe that either one of us was completely right about who she was. To me, her belief in the League had always seemed naive. I really thought she blinded herself to everything going on around her to stay in that happy world that existed only in her mind. Maybe Jude really was right,
and the League of Today didn't remotely resemble the one she had willingly joined years ago. Then why did she only give herself up to me in pieces? And why had it taken me so long to put them together into a somewhat complete picture?
You've been communicating directly with Kate, I suppose.
Chubbs took the chatter out of my limp hand and turned it over.
She's been guiding you along?
Yeah, Vida said. She sent me the routes to get down here. Too bad she couldn't just load his ass into Google Maps. Not even Nico has been able to track him. The screen between Chubbs's fingers flashed to life and let out a low, vibrating growl. The light it emitted was bright enough that we could all watch as his eyebrows rose steadily up past his glasses frames to his hairline.
Well, maybe she can't send exact coordinates, he said, flipping it around, but she has an idea of where we could start.
12. Target sighted outside Nashville. Hostile blue tribe in nearby area. Approach with caution.
The sighting isn't listed in the Skip Tracer network, Chubbs said.
His finger flicked against the screen of the small tablet I had fished out of the glove box for him, scrolling down.
That's not surprising, though. I haven't been able to pick up an internet signal in a few days to download an update.
What is that thing? I asked. At the top of the color screen was Liam's bruised, scowling face, the picture that had been taken, I guess, when he was brought into Caledonia. Next to the photo was a list of the same information I had been able to access in the PSF network, the only update being that his reward had gone up to $200,000, and his last reported sighting was outside of Richmond, Virginia.
It has direct access to the Skip Tracer network, Chubbs said. You get one after you register and are approved by the government. The information on there is closely guarded. The PSFs don't have access to it, so they can't swoop in and steal a score.
It was a touchscreen, easy enough to flick through the various listings beneath it. A skip tracer named P. Everton had been the one to sight him in Richmond. He had posted the following on Liam's listing. Stewart driving red Chevy truck, stolen plates, target in jeans and black hooded sweatshirt. Lost sight of car during pursuit. Why would they be sharing information with one another like this? I asked, if only one of them gets the reward.
Because if a tip turns out to be good, you're upped in the standings. Each kid, especially the big bounties, are assigned points in addition to dollar amounts. But you can also earn points by adding tips or supporting the PSFs when they are trying to locate a kid.
Chubbs shrugged.
The top 20 or so skip tracers get more supplies from the government, not to mention better equipment, and easy access to the internet. That alone makes a huge difference. I can't even tell you how many stupid kids have been found because of the pictures and postings their families had online. I think that's probably how the PSFs found me the first time. Mom forgot she had an album of our cabin up on some website.
I nodded, continuing to scroll through the list. There were only about 1,000 or so active listings of kids, many of them without pictures. These, I assumed, were the lucky ones who had been added to the online IAAN registry by their unsuspecting parents for updates and instructions from the government, but who had avoided being collected and brought into a camp. They had either found a great place to hide, or had mastered the art of living off the grid. I kept scrolling. Dale, Andrea. Dale, George Ryan. Daly, Jacob Marcus. Daly, Ruby. The picture was of a 10-year-old me, eyes wide under a ratty mess of wet, dark hair. That's right, I thought. It had been raining the day they brought us in.
What the hell?
I held it up for him to see. $400,000
for a reward? What? Oh, that.
Chubbs plucked the tablet from my hands and said grimly,
Congratulations, you're officially a big score.
Why?
Do you really need me to break it down for you? He said, sighing. You escaped from Thurmond with the help of the League and are, oh, by the way, an orange.
What are all of the listings? I asked. I've never been in Maine or Georgia. He held the screen up for me to see.
Look closer.
Sighted outside of Marietta, Georgia, moving east, J. Lister. At least five of them were from J. Lister, otherwise known as the teenager in the driver's seat next to me.
I would have done more, but you get penalized for spamming the network with false tips. I try to do that for you and Lee whenever I can, to throw off the other skip tracers.
What about Zoo?
Same, he said, but not nearly as much. It looks bad when you're only updating for the same kids and not thinking about distances and all that. I can't post that I saw you in Maine and, 2 minutes later, post I saw her in California. I have a story for her figured out, though. As far as the skip tracers know, she's somewhere in Florida.
Do you think she and the others actually made it to California? I asked. There haven't been any updates in the PSF network the League had access to. I checked last week again, and still nothing. Chubbs cleared his throat.
I'd like to think she did. Once we find Lee, we'll just have to go see for ourselves.
The others were in our line of sight, out of the front windshield. Vida was attempting to take down the tent by beating it into submission. Jude was simply stretched out on his back in a grassy patch of earth, staring up at the sky, the compass resting on his chest. It was cold, but the sunlight was out for the first time in days. He was regarding the sky with a kind of amazed wonderment.
What do you think he's looking at? Chubbs asked, craning his neck forward over the wheel to follow Jude's gaze up. Is that kid mentally sound?
I would guess his brain is about 10,000 miles away from here, crafting the tale of this heroic adventure, I said. But, yeah, he's a sweet kid, hyperactive, totally unwilling to accept reality, but sweet.
If you say so, Chubbs muttered.
Vida let out a strangled scream, uprooting one of the pikes holding the tent in place. She reached down and flipped the whole structure over onto its side and smashed her foot into it for good measure.
Why am I the only one working? She yelled. Hello?
Chubbs was already bursting out of his door before I had a hand on mine.
Could you not destroy my tent, you incompetent, ungrateful wretch? He bellowed. I'm incompetent?
Vida's voice went hoarse.
Who's the stupid asshole who threw away the instructions?
With one quick glance to make sure Vida wasn't going to impale Chubbs with the pike she held in her hand, I reached for the tablet and switched it back on. For 2, 3, 4 agonizing seconds, all I saw was the slow spin of a gray circle as the device loaded itself. It snapped to the home screen with a small beep, a tiny menu that ranged from emergency to database to updates. Above that was a digital map of the United States, one that looked like it could be used for actual navigation. That wasn't what I needed it for. My stomach was clenched into a tight fist of anxiety, but my fingers were steady as I typed in the name. Gray. Clancy. And then the pain released with a single long breath. No records found. It was another 4 hours to Nashville, with Chubbs and me splitting the driving duties. Seeing him behind the wheel instead of the seat behind me was strange enough, but his relaxed, confident posture there made him look like a different person. I was forcing myself to adapt, trying to come to terms with the fact that this Chubbs was not the one who had been taken from me. How could he be, after everything? Aside from his reaction to Vida's baiting and insults, he was calmer, outwardly. Every now and then I would look over and see a shadow flit across the sharp lines of his face. Tell me, I would think, but the thick clouds would pass overhead, peeling back to submerge the road in brilliant sunlight, and he'd look like himself again, at least until it came time to eat. In the past, Chubbs had complained and railed against just the idea of stopping to have one of us go in and buy food from a store or restaurant. It had always been Liam who went out to buy it, with Chubbs's loud protests trailing behind him like a nagging shadow.
Oh, come on. It'll be fine,
he said when he insisted on parking at a rest stop with a handful of people already milling around it. It was becoming readily apparent that he used his skip tracer identification like it was a bulletproof shield,
flashing it to anyone who gave him a second look. A part of me wondered if he was too used to playing this part, or if something inside him had really shifted. The rest of us waited, scooted as far down in our seats as possible, while Chubbs took his time using the restroom, mining the vending machines, and breathing in the fresh wintry air.
"I thought you said this kid was smart," Vida hissed.
"He is." I watched him over the curve of the dashboard.
"Then he's just freaking rude," she shot back. "Or he's trying to get us caught."
No, it wasn't that. Chubbs was a lot of things, but he wasn't malicious enough to try to push someone out who needed his help.
"Oh, really?"
came the small voice at the back of my mind. "Isn't that exactly what he tried to do with you?" I shook my head as he climbed back into the SUV, tossing his haul of chips and candy onto my lap. Chubbs glanced at me, then looked again.
"What are you doing?"
My lips parted in surprise.
"What do you think? Any of these people could have reported us."
Chubbs' brows drew together, the realization finally coming to him. He looked at the others, still crouched down in the back. Jude had his arms wrapped around his knees, burrowed down into the gully of space between the metal grate and his seat.
"Yep," Vida said to no one in particular. "Just a fucking idiot."
"It's okay," Jude said with forced brightness. "They wouldn't have called us in. They didn't look like PSFs or skip tracers anyway." Skip tracers didn't have a look. Chubbs was evidence of that. He had maybe dressed the part, but he wasn't one of them. He didn't have that detached coldness that seemed to permeate from the others. His reaction now, the way he jammed his key into the ignition, made me wonder if he had ever noticed how irresponsible he was being until this very moment. It didn't become a real problem until we reached the outskirts of Nashville and the blockade the National Guard had set up and staffed with a few dozen of their finest.
"City closed," Jude said, reading the spray-painted sign we flew past.
It was a series of signs, one after another.
"Flood zone. Slow. City closed. Turn back. National Guard entry only. City closed."
Jude's voice dropped just a little bit more with each one he read, but the SUV only picked up speed. The makeshift station began as a dark, blurry line at the horizon of the snow-slick road and took shape, one barbed tangle of wires and fence at a time.
"Slow down," I told Chubbs. "Stop for a second."
He ignored both requests. Vida glanced up from where she had been typing out another message to Kate on the chatter.
"Oh, yeah. Kate said the city's been blocked off since the summer. Something about how a river flooded the city and some people started rioting when they didn't get any aid."
I sighed, pressing my face into my hands. That information would have been useful to know 20 minutes ago. Back when we were, you know, in the middle of a discussion about the best way into the city. Vida shrugged. Jude began, a distinct note of panic in his voice.
"There's a guy coming toward us. He's coming toward us really freaking fast."
Sure enough, a National Guardsman had pulled away from the chain-link fence and dirty yellow barrels they were using to block our path down the road. He was jogging, his gun and supplies jostling with each step. A spike of cold panic shot straight up my spine. The National Guardsman stopped, his hand drifting to the firearm at his side. Then Chubbs asked,
"Does everyone have their seatbelt on?"
"You're joking," I began.
There was no way. He would never. Vida finally looked up from the chatter. Jude yelped as the car lurched forward. Chubbs had floored the pedal. I reached over and jerked the wheel, forcing the car to veer sharply to the left. Chubbs tried to shove me off, but I guided the car around, narrowly missing the soldier who had come out to meet us. He eased up immediately on the gas, but we were already headed back in the right direction, away from the fence, the soldiers, and danger. Vida slammed her palm against the grate, and the pedal floored under her influence, locked hard against the SUV's dirty carpet. Chubbs tried pumping the brakes, and the car seemed to shriek in protest. When the blockade was finally a small blip in the rearview mirror,
Vida lifted her hand and Chubbs's foot came down on the brake. The seatbelts snapped over our chests. I started when I'd finally caught my breath.
Why? You...
Damn it!
Chubbs began, slapping his hand against the steering wheel. He didn't sound like himself. He had yelled at me before, countless times, but this was... I actually felt myself shrink.
How dare you do that? How dare you?
If you're going to fight, can you do it outside? Vida said. I already have a big enough headache without hearing Mommy and Daddy at each other's throats.
Fine by me. I unbuckled my seatbelt, ignoring Chubbs's growl as he did the same.
What?
He demanded, coming around to meet me at the front of the SUV. His boots slid through the snow, clinging to the dark surface of the road. His breath was hot with anger. It fanned out white and sticky against my stinging cheeks.
What was that? I asked. Were you really going to force your way through?
It was how he shrugged, like it didn't matter, like it was nothing that made me crazy.
I can't believe it, I said. Wake up. Wake up. This isn't like you at all.
I wouldn't have had to do it if you didn't stick me with those stupid kids. I could have flashed some papers and we would have been in.
He dragged a hand through his tuft of dark hair.
And you know what? Even if I had gone through with it, it's not like they would have caught up to us. Honestly, weren't you and Lee the ones who always said we had to take risks if we were going to get by?
Are you...
I could barely choke the word out.
Are you serious? Risks? Where is your head? You are so much smarter than this.
Did it matter that I was yelling, or that he was doing his best to try to tower over me with his height? Did it matter that the other two were watching us through the windshield?
Sure, we would have gotten through the blockade, maybe even miles away. But what if they got your license plate number and reported that? What if up the road there was another blockade and they were waiting for us there? What would you have done? You're the only one with papers. You would have been fine, but if they had taken me, or Jude, or Vida, could you have lived with that?
What about Liam? He shouted. You know, the one whose brain you decided to fry? The one who's lost, or dead, or near to it because you decided to screw with him? Remember him?
Every inch of my skin felt like the branches of the trees overhead, stripped bare and coated with frost. You do blame me.
Who else would I blame? He shouted. It's your fault, damn it! And now you're acting like this? Like those kids are more important to you than us? Yeah, I've had to make a few changes, so what? I've been getting on just fine, making my own decisions. You keep acting like I'm still bleeding out in your hands, but I'm fine. I am better than fine. You're the one who's wrong. You're...
I hadn't even heard the door open, but Vida was suddenly standing beside me, her shoulder pressed against mine.
Back off.
I felt her hand close around my wrist.
You don't want us here, ass clown. Fine, we're out.
Jude was white-faced as he scurried around the back, clutching our few possessions in his hands.
I'm ready,
he said, his voice betraying none of the fear I saw in his eyes.
Let's go.
I took the leather jacket that Jude passed to me, my mind trying to catch up with what was happening. Chubbs's fingers caught the pocket and held tight.
What are you doing?
I think... My whole face felt numb. I think this was a bad idea.
No,
my brain was screaming.
No, no, no!
Ruby,
he said, shocked.
Tell me you're not... Ruby!
You think we're worthless? You want to prove that you're so damn brave?
Vida shouted back.
Go ahead and get your stupid ass killed. We'll see who finds Stuart first.
Vida hooked her arm through mine and began to haul me down the slight curve of the highway's shoulder, down into the snow-splattered forest ahead. It was deep and dark and lovely. I couldn't see the beginning or end of it.
Asshole! She was muttering. God damn him, I hate his stupid ass face and his stupid ass driving, acting like we're as dumb as dirt. Asshole!
Jude jogged to keep pace with us. Branches snapped around my face, clawing at my hair.
The flashes of sunlight through the treetops were disorienting, blinding red one moment and orange the next, and all I could think was fire. All I could see was Chubbs's face close to mine as we clung to each other under the dock at East River while the world burned above us. I felt a hand touch the small of my back, and I just couldn't do it anymore. My legs buckled, and I barely managed to catch myself on a tree before I collapsed completely. "What are you doing?" I thought. "This is Chubbs. This is still Chubbs." For several agonizing minutes, I couldn't hear anything beyond my own harsh breathing. I felt physically ill, like I was about to heave up everything in the pit of my stomach. "This is Chubbs, who says things he constantly regrets, even if they're the truth, who lets his anger get the best of him, especially when he's afraid. And you left him. You walked away. That was Chubbs, and you left him." I felt a hand tugging on mine. Jude stood beside me, his EMT jacket crinkling. "I think you were both wrong," he said quietly. "He doesn't blame you for what ended up happening with Liam. He blames himself. He's only acting like this because he's gotten to the point where he's willing to do anything to set it right." "Why would he think any of this is his fault, though?" I asked.
"He's a loose cannon," Vida said, glancing back over her shoulder. "He survived being shot. Some part of him thinks he's invincible and that he can make stupid mistakes and get away with it. There are other ways he could have traveled, but he chose to run with the fucking wolves. If he's not desperate, if he doesn't hate himself, then he really is just a goddamn idiot."
"You guys don't know him," I started.
"No," Jude said carefully. "But we know you. And if you think you haven't been acting the same exact way he has for the past 6 months, then you're a goddamn idiot, too."
Vida turned me back in the direction of the road and gave me a hard shove.
"Go get him, then. If you're not back in 5 minutes, we'll head out on our own to find Stuart. You said you didn't have a choice in joining the League? Well, congrat you freaking-lations. Now you do. Come back with us or don't. But I'm more than capable of doing this up without all of your boo-hoo issues holding me down."
I read her meaning loud and clear.
"I'll be back," I told them. "Right back, I swear."
I took a lurching step forward, keeping my eyes on our staggered footprints in the snow, keeping them focused down and ahead because I couldn't stand to think of the others watching me go. I can't leave them, any of them. Not Vida, who was too headstrong for her own good. Not Jude, who couldn't stand the silence or the dark. Not Chubbs, not after everything. The SUV was still there, parked crookedly on the shoulder. He was in the driver's seat, leaning against the steering wheel. I walked around the back of the car, glancing both ways down the road to make sure there were no other eyes on us, then pulled Liam's jacket around me tighter for support. He didn't see me. His shoulders were shaking, but I wasn't sure if he was only breathing hard or actually crying. I knocked on the window, and Chubbs, my Chubbs, about leaped into the passenger seat in terror. "I'm sorry," I mouthed through the glass. He had been crying. Something inside me twisted, sharp and firm, as Chubbs opened the door.
"You scared the hell out of me," he shouted. "Do you know how easy it is to fall and break an ankle when you're walking without directions? Or into a frozen river? Do you know what happens when you get hypothermia?"
I leaned in and wrapped my arms around his shoulders.
I mean...
he began. I felt his hands bunch up the back of Liam's jacket with the effort to keep me there.
"I'm not the same person. I'm not, and I know that. I'm not okay with who I am or what I had to do, but I'm also not okay with us separating again. Don't do that. Don't just disappear. If you're mad at me, then hit me or something. Just don't think that I don't want to stay with you. I'll always want to stay with you."
I tightened my grip on him, pressing my face against his shoulder. You're different, too, he said. It's all different now. I just wanted to go back to the way it was when we were in that stupid minivan. Jesus, will you say something?
Don't, I said. Call Black Betty stupid.
I don't know if he was laughing or just crying again, but both of us shook with the force of it.
I miss him, he was saying. I miss him so much. I know it's stupid. I'm scared.
He's not dead, I cut in. He's not. He can't be. Chubbs pulled back slowly, lifting his glasses to swipe his arm over his eyes.
That's not what I mean. I'm scared of what he'll say when he finds out about this.
His hands settled again on the wheel.
All of this.
He'll probably make some stupid joke at your expense, I said, and give you another dumb nickname.
No,
he said, clearly struggling.
He'll know.
I suddenly felt very still. There was no other way to describe the dread that crept over me when Chubbs turned away from me.
I told you before about all the paperwork that you need to fill out to register as a skip tracer, he said. But that's only half of it.
Half? I repeated. He nodded, looking miserable.
In order to establish yourself, you have to turn in a kid. There's no other way to put your name in the rankings. You can't cheat the system. Believe me, I tried.
It took an immeasurable amount of time for what he was saying to sink in. With each second that passed, his face became more and more transparent. His thoughts and fears flashed by, unchecked. Who? I asked finally.
Some green kid I found in New York.
Chubbs swallowed hard.
He had been living rough for a few years. I could tell by the look of him. Haunted, you know. Hungry. He was practically gaunt. I only saw him because he was trying to break a vending machine at one of those outdoor malls. It was in the middle of the day. There was a whole crowd of people watching him, not getting close to him.
What happened?
I don't know. He didn't even put up much of a fight, Chubbs said, his voice hoarse with emotion. He just looked at me, and I could see that he had given up. And at the time, I was thinking, you know, that he would at least have food in a camp. He would have a bed. He was only a green. They would treat him okay if he kept his head down.
You had to.
What else could I say to that? It was the only way. Is that how I'm supposed to explain myself to Lee? Oh, sorry, your life was more important than his? He's not going to understand.
Chubbs cleared his throat.
The fact of the matter is, I would have done a lot worse. I would have done anything to find you guys. It scares me. I feel like if there's not someone there to stop me, I'm not sure what I would do.
That was a feeling I knew well. The sensation of free falling into a dark pit, not knowing how soon you'll hit the bottom of it, or if there even is one. It won't matter, I said. In the end, it won't. After we find Liam and get the intel, you better believe I'm going to burn every single one of those camps to the ground. He looked so uncertain about it, it broke my heart. I have to. Will you stay with me on this? I whispered. After a moment, Chubbs nodded.
All right.
He cleared his throat again, trying to force it back to its usual gruff tone.
Where did the others go?
They're waiting for us.
Are we walking then? He asked. I'll have to try to hide the car.
I stared at him a moment, confused. Then I understood. He's letting you lead. Yeah, I said. I think we should try to get into the city on foot. Chubbs nodded, and there wasn't any discussion after that. We took the car a ways down the highway until we found a smaller access road. With the SUV properly masked in the trees and under whatever foliage we could find, we set off into the woods.
I haven't done this in a while,
Chubb said, shifting the pack we had put together of supplies and one of the 25 zillion first aid kits he had insisted on packing. He was smiling. Just a faint touch, but it was still there. "Wish I could say the same," I said, putting a hand on his shoulder to help steady myself as I hauled my legs over a fallen tree. "Where did you say they were?" I hadn't even realized we were back in the same small clearing as before until I saw the dizzy array of footsteps pounded out in the mud and mulch. They'd been good on their word, then. They had split, and we'd have to catch up to them. I looked over at Chubbs to tell him as much, but his eyes were focused down on the snow, his eyebrows knit together. There were more than 3 sets of tracks here. My brain had taken one look and assumed that Jude had been pacing in his usual way, or that Vida had been circling the clearing impatiently, but there were way too many footprints for that. I saw it then, the way it must have happened. A spiraling circle of steps where Vida had tried to fight, ending in the exposed patch of earth where she had fallen. Across the way, branches broken and littered on the ground. I took another step forward, following the trail until my feet met with a small spray of blazing bright blood on a melting patch of snow. No. The wind took on a low, menacing growl in my ears. They hadn't gone on ahead. They had been taken. 13. It didn't even occur to me that Chubbs might not be able to keep up with my pace as I ran. The group had cleared a path through the mud and pockets of lingering snow, packing it down to a manageable level with their feet. I took in a deep gulp of the dry air, trying to ignore the snow slipping from the low branches of trees and brush as I tore through them. My pants and coat were soaked through by the time I finally skidded to a stop. The trail of prints, so wide and obvious before, came to a definite end at the lip of a frozen stream. Chubbs panted heavily as he came up beside me, one hand pressed hard against his shoulder. I turned to take the bag of supplies he'd packed, but then thought twice. The one he handed me was just as heavy, and I wouldn't be able to get through the snow with both of them, at least not quickly. "What now?" he gasped between breaths. "They crossed here?" "No, it's not possible," I said, kneeling down to test the ice. "There had to be at least 10 of them. There's no way they all would have made it across without breaking the ice." His eyes narrowed at me as I stood. "You can tell all that just by a few prints?" "No," I said. "I don't know the exact number, 10 or more. Vida wouldn't have let herself be taken by any less." Chubbs looked doubtful, but he didn't deny the possibility. I walked a ways along the bank of the stream, looking for stray tracks, human or otherwise. They couldn't have just vanished here. "Shit," I thought, threading my fingers through the messy bun I had twisted my hair into. "Shit!" "Could..." Chubbs swallowed, shifting the bag uncomfortably on his shoulders. "Do you think they were taken by soldiers? Ones the blockade sent after us?" I shook my head. "They would have taken the road. We would have seen them." Or at least that was what I was telling myself. "Skip tracers, maybe?" This time he was the one to shoot the thought down. 10 of them? Why would they all be out here in the middle of nowhere?" "Then..." I began. Chubbs's eyes widened as he caught my train of thought. "The tribe of Blues we're looking for?" he asked. "But why put up a fight?" I fought back the first sting of panicked tears. Oh, God. Jude must have been terrified. "They don't understand how it works. They don't have a life outside of the League. We were taught to only trust one another." It was only dumb luck that I turned back to the stream when I did, that the wind pulled back the evergreen foliage of the trees across the way. Otherwise, I would have missed the silver glint of gunmetal between its branches. I threw myself over Chubbs, tackling him face first into the ground as the first shot was fired. I felt something tug on my backpack, and I turned away from the small explosion of snow and dirty leaves when the bullet tore through the ground beside us. The bullets screeched as they cut through the air following our path as I rolled the two of us back into the shelter of the tree line.
Keep your head down,
I whispered to Chubbs, all but shoving him behind a dense cover of growth. The gun I'd fished out of the glove compartment was warm in my hand as I pulled it up from the waistband of my pants. I fired one shot back, aiming for the spot I thought I had seen the person before, across the stream. The shooting from his or her end came to a sudden, unexpected stop. The afternoon air was pale and still between us. It had a sharp quality to it. It smelled like snow.
Ruby!
A dark blur dropped out of the tree behind me. I spun, without thinking, and launched my elbow out. It connected with something soft that made an audible crunch as I threw my full weight into the hit. There was a sharp cry of pain, followed by a heavy thump. The impact sent up whirling clouds of snow. I turned back for Chubbs, reaching out for him through the white haze, and felt a hand close over my forearm. The skin was pale, each knuckle torn open or scabbed. I pulled back a step, bringing my knee up to throw the next attacker off, but the fight was over before it started. I felt a cold, sharp blade dig into my spinal column and lowered my arms. I turned, slightly, to look over my shoulder at Chubbs. He was covered in mud, his face ashen. "Who are you?" I said, coming around slowly to face him, keeping clear of the knife.
"Son of a bitch!"
he hissed. The pitch of his voice had been enough to tell me how old he actually was. My age, a year or two older at most. The boy I'd hit staggered up from the ground, swiping his nose against the sleeve of his threadbare coat, leaving a long, dark streak of crimson on it. The kid with the knife stepped back, but didn't put it away. Bloody Nose held out his hand, and I reached out, acting like I was about to put my gun in it. At the last minute, I dropped it and took his hand instead, driving into his mind. His body twitched under my control. I saw a flash of Jude's frightened face in his mind, and it was enough for me.
"What did you do to those kids?" I snarled. "The boy and the girl from earlier. Where did you take them?"
Chubbs had a strange look on his face as he watched me, but he stayed silent.
"The guys,"
he said, his voice altered by the sickening angle of his nose. My elbow ached in response.
"The guys brought them to the slip kid."
"Of course." Those were the first words that sprang to mind, that chipped through the ice that gripped me in place. Of course. Clancy's system had worked so well the first time, why wouldn't he try it again? Of course. It wouldn't matter who the kids were, only that they'd be willing, or easily swayed by his abilities, to go to war with President Gray. Of course. I had to release the kid from my grip when four other figures appeared in the woods around us, closing in to investigate what had happened. I could control one person, but I wasn't Clancy. Any more than that was impossible, and any attempts to try would have revealed the only upper hand I currently had. I stepped forward, showed them I was unarmed, and motioned for Chubbs to do the same.
"We want to see the slip kid," I said. "We won't give you trouble."
"That a fact?"
one of them asked, glancing down at the dazed kid at my feet.
"Michael, you hear that? Or did that hit knock your screws loose?"
Bloodnose, Michael, shook his head in an obvious attempt to clear it. A head injury was a decent cover for what I had done to him, but it was taking his little brain so long to recover, I was worried the other boys around us would get suspicious. They didn't seem willing or able to do anything without his permission.
"We're taking them," Michael said. "Make it fast. Two of you stay on this post. I'll send someone back for you."
This guy is the leader, I thought. It wasn't unreasonable. His size alone would have inspired fear, if nothing else. They pushed Chubbs toward me as we made our way back to the stream. I looped one arm around his waist to keep him close. They took our bags and hauled them up onto their shoulders.
"Well,"
Chubbs muttered,
"shit."
We were out in the open again, near the frozen stream, and, more importantly, in the line of sight of the gunman in the tree. There were hands on me, patting me down, feeling around the insides of my boots,
I tried not to react as one took my Swiss Army knife from my boot. The freezing air stung my face, but it was the thought of what they might find in Chubbs's pockets that made me go cold to the bone. Chubbs must have read the question on my face, because he shook his head ever so slightly. The kid searching him only found his knife and a pocketful of candy wrappers. He had been with it enough to dump his skip tracer ID in the woods during the attack, or leave it behind in the car then. Thank God. I turned to look across the river, narrowly avoiding Chubbs's kicking feet as he was lifted off the ground and out of my reach. He thrashed into the air in the half-second it took for the kid with the outstretched hand to lift him up and, using nothing more than his freak abilities, toss him onto the opposite bank. I felt the warm tug at the pit of my stomach and recognized the sensation. I didn't have the chance to protest before I was hauled up and over the stream, too, dropped onto Chubbs with a total and complete lack of kindness. The other kids burst out laughing, floating one another over the frozen stream with all the gentleness of calming breezes. Other than that, they didn't speak, didn't offer up a single explanation or confirmation of where they were taking us. Two stayed behind to snuff out our tracks in the soft white powder. We walked in silence. Snow began to fall, catching on my hair and lashes, and cold crept in through the leather of Liam's coat. Chubbs tensed, rubbing his bad shoulder absently. I caught his gaze, and I could see my anxiety mirrored in his dark eyes. "I can't believe it," he muttered. "Again." "I'll take care of him," I said quietly, looping my arm through his.
"Since that worked so well last time?"
"Hey!" Michael held up his silver handgun. "Shut the hell up!" We were on foot long enough that I began to wonder if we were ever going to reach the encampment, or wherever they planned on taking us. It didn't occur to me until the large river came into sight that we were moving toward Nashville. I understood straight off why they had originally closed the city. Though the river must have surged past its banks months before, most of the water had yet to freeze or pull completely back to its normal level. The water's edges were bloated, drowning the nearby landscape. The river was a monster that only grew larger the closer we came. It was the only thing that stood between us and a looming white warehouse across the way. Waiting for us on the bank were three small, flat rafts that looked like nothing more than crates and spare planks stitched together with bright blue vinyl rope. A kid in white stood on each of them, gripping a long pole. With a group of us spread out over the three rafts, the kids with poles pushed and navigated us through the shallow, muddy water in slow, methodic movements. My fists clenched at my sides. One of the loading docks of the warehouse was open and waiting. With a steadiness I didn't expect, the raft floated the rest of the way to the curled silver door and the dark room inside. The loading platform was raised enough that the rafts were no longer necessary. I was lifted up by the waist and deposited into the arms of another kid waiting there. The girl who caught me was a skinny, pale thing, her green eyes jutting out of the blunt bones of her face. She let out a wet, rumbling cough that came up from deep within her chest, but she didn't say anything as she took my arm and forced me inside. The walls and floors were cement, cracked and tagged within an inch of their lives with old, faded graffiti. The warehouse was roughly the size of a high school gymnasium, and it still held a few clues about its past life. Signs marking where cables and wires could be left. The back wall, the one we were walking toward, had been painted a light robin's egg blue, and though someone had tried to cover them with a layer of white paint, I could still read the black letters spelling out Johnson Electric beneath it. Chubbs fell in step beside me, nodding toward the brown line that ran along all of the walls, about halfway up toward the ceiling. So the water from the river had been that high? Every single step I took, every voice around us, every drip of water from the cracks in the vaulted ceiling seemed to echo. The sounds played off the bare walls and boarded up windows around us. Despite the fact that we were out of the snow and wind, the building wasn't insulated to keep out the persistent chill. Old metal trash cans had been repurposed to hold bonfires,
but most of these were located toward the other end of the warehouse, not near the patches of kids scattered by the entrance we had come through. This wasn't anything like East River had been. And the teenage boy, sitting on the raised platform in the back, disappearing in and out of a haze of cigarette and fire smoke, was not Clancy Gray. "Who the hell are you?" There had been a low murmur of interest as we were hauled in, but at my words, it dropped off to silence. My eyes had gone straight to the kid's face, snapping over to it so quickly that I hadn't even noticed the other teens around him until they stepped forward for a better look. There were girls shivering in t-shirts and shorts, leaning against the base of the stage or draped along the crates stacked behind him with only a few blankets between them. Clusters of boys stood around them laughing, some feeding the cloud of putrid gray smoke with their own cigarettes. This kid had to be closer to his 20s than the others. His face was fringed with the beginning of a reddish beard, which he was busy rubbing against the cheek of a girl with long, dirty, blonde hair perched on his lap. She was shaking, but I couldn't tell if it was out of fear or cold. When she turned to look at me, I realized the bruise at the edge of her mouth extended all the way to her jaw. The kid's blonde hair was long but slicked back neatly behind his ears. His standard-issue combat boots and PSF's black uniform jacket were spotted with mud, but otherwise looked pristine. A little too pristine to have ever been in real use.
"Excuse me?"
A southern accent. "Who?" I repeated. "The hell are you?" All of the teens who sat on his platform turned to look at him in perfect time with one another, but he was only staring at me. I felt the warm tug in my stomach again, and, despite Chubbs's attempt to grab me, my feet slid across the dusty floor toward him. I barely managed to catch myself before I crashed against the side of the platform. Old stacked crates with water-warped plywood nailed over them. That was all that stage was. His chair was little more than a metal folding one with a fuzzy blanket draped over it, most likely for effect. The teen stood, throwing the girl off him. When she cried out in surprise, he thrust the bowl of whatever he had been eating toward her to shut her up. I fought the urge to search for Vida and Jude in the shadows crawling up around us.
"Where did you find them?"
He crouched down at the edge of the platform to peer at my face. His eyes were green, for the most part. A large blotch of brown covered the upper half of his right eye.
"Up by the creek," Michael answered. "You,"
the leader said, turning to one of the girls on the stage.
"Give him that blanket before he freezes. This guy is a king tonight. Look at the haul he brought in."
The girl didn't seem to understand why or how he could ask her to do something like that. She stared, dumb and mute, at his back, until one of the boys grabbed a fistful of her short, chestnut hair and shoved her forward to the edge of the raised platform. Underneath the warm brown wool sheet, she was wearing a stained yellow t-shirt and a pair of someone's old boxers. No shoes, no socks. Michael ripped the blanket from her fingers, clucking his tongue at her resistance. One of the other kids, a small boy, gave him the water bottle he had been holding, watching with hooded eyes as the bigger kid polished off the rest of it before tossing the crushed bottle back to him. Then he fell into place at the leader's right. How it was even possible for someone to look so smug and proud, cocooned in a blanket with dried blood all over his face, was beyond me. The leader tossed his cigarette onto the ground at our feet, one end still glowing a pulsing red. I kept my eyes at the sliver of exposed skin above the collar of the PSF jacket. An unworn jacket. I had worked on enough of them in the factory to recognize one at first glance. There were no patches, not even the standard American flag. Unless he had ripped all of the stitching out, which was unlikely given that the material wasn't frayed, he had probably plucked the jacket out of a shipment, rather than off a soldier. He broke his gaze long enough to glance at Michael. A tight shark's smile stretched across his lips.
"He did that?"
A nod toward Chubbs. The other team used his new blanket to wipe at the crusted blood covering his top lip. He opened his mouth, but then clearly thought better about admitting a girl half his size had given his face an adjustment. The first let out a low laugh as he turned back to me.
Elbow, fist, or foot?
Elbow, I said. I'm happy to perform a demonstration on you, if you need one. The muttering was back, a few wolfish chuckles rising around me. I set my jaw to keep from saying something else equally stupid. Curb it, I told myself. Feel him out.
A fighter?
He asked, raising his eyebrows.
What's your color, baby?
I didn't realize Chubbs had moved at all until he was standing beside me.
She's green, I'm blue. And you are?
They call me Knox, he said. The name Slip Kid mean anything to you?
If you're the Slip Kid, Chubb said, I'm the goddamn Easter Bunny. This is supposed to be East River?
Knox stood suddenly at that, his amused smile tightening into a much harsher one.
Not what you thought it'd be?
We caught them the same place we grabbed the other two, just off the highway, Michael supplied oh so helpfully. That girl was a blue, too. We could have an initiation tonight.
Knox silenced him with a look. Overhead, the snow had apparently warmed to rain. It slanted down over the metal roof, the only sound aside from the eager whisperings of the kids crowding in around us.
What do you know about East River? He demanded.
Well, to begin with, Chubbs began, crossing his arms over his chest.
We heard it was in Virginia. I cut him off. We were heading that way when your friends picked us up. Here was the thing. This smug kid, whoever he was, wherever he had come from, was clearly not the real Slip Kid. We knew that. Knox knew that. But if he knew that we knew, I didn't doubt for a second that Knox would dispose of us before we could let everyone else in on the secret, too. The name was legendary. Anyone who could gather this many kids, set up this kind of shop, why wouldn't they believe he was the Slip Kid?
This is some operation you have, I continued, straining my neck to look behind me.
No Jude, no Vida. But this was clearly the tribe of blues Kate had tried to warn us about.
A nice little place. Is this everyone?
Knox snorted, motioning to one of the younger teens next to him. The boy, 12 or maybe 13, went fire red at the attention. Knox muttered something in his ear, and the boy nodded once, then took a running leap off the platform. The last I saw of him was the back of his navy jacket, stained with soot, disappearing out one of the side doors.
I'm Ruby, I said, then thrust a thumb toward Chubbs. This is Charles. Like I said, we are just making our way through, heading east.
Knox returned to his seat and, without any sort of prompt, the same girl as before scurried back to him, handing him the bowl of food. Soup, judging by the splatters that hit his jacket. I didn't miss the way the teens around him seemed to lean in, watching as the broth vanished spoonful by spoonful. Do not look at Chubbs, I ordered myself. I wouldn't have been able to hold back. The girl, in her threadbare outfit, was skin hanging off bird-like bones. Knox waved Michael forward, and he and another teen dumped our backpacks on the platform. Two other girls, younger than the first, sprang to action. Piece by piece, they disassembled the packs of supplies we had so carefully stowed. Goodbye, food bars. Goodbye, first aid kits. Goodbye, water bottles and blankets and matches. Each item they took out was enough to break the thin control I had on my anger. I shifted my eyes up toward where Knox was watching this process, wondering how good it would feel to take his mind apart in the same way. It would be easy if I could just get close to him. When Knox glanced up at us, it was with a completely new expression on his face, one that was hungry, excited.
Where did you get all this stuff?
We picked over an old gas station, I said, taking a small step closer. It's ours. We found it.
What's yours is mine, baby, he said. Everyone here has to earn his or her things.
Chubbs grumbled something under his breath.
Take this all to storage, Knox told Michael. Then you and your guys can eat as much as you want.
Michael grinned, gathering the blanket more firmly around his coat. His team was jumping all over themselves with excitement, pushing past one another to go out the same side door the boy had earlier, except for one teen, the one who hung at the back of the pack. He was average height, wearing an army green coat that was a size too small and had to be worn open. His hair was as long and wild as the others in his group, but he kept his out of his face with a fleece hunter's hat. Just before the door shut, something must have caught his eye, because he turned back, leaning up against the wall there.
Are you with the kids my guys picked up earlier?
Knox asked, drawing my attention back to him. A heavy gold chain slipped out from beneath his undershirt and jacket as he leaned forward.
The hot piece and the scarecrow?
Well, that was one way to describe them. No, I said. Another step closer. Another. I have no idea who you're talking about.
Roo!
Every head in the warehouse swiveled toward that side door. A river of relief broke through me. Vida and Jude stood there, looking slightly worse for wear, but whole. Both of them were without jackets. Jude had given up any sort of pretense of pretending he wasn't freezing, but Vida's jaw was clenched tight, her arms pressed hard against her sides. I saw something flicker in her eyes, but she didn't say anything. I wished the same could have been said for Jude.
See?
He was saying as he poked her arm. I told you they'd come! I sighed, turning back to Knox and the platform.
Wanna try that answer again, sweetness?
He asked coldly. I shrugged and said nothing.
Damn it. So a green, a yellow, and two blues walk into my woods,
Knox began. He stood and hopped down over the edge of the platform. Vida and Jude were shoved toward us. He was pacing in front of us, to the amusement of the other kids, just out of my reach.
Now, the two blues, you're mighty welcome here, but of course we'll have to figure out which of you is actually strong enough to join the hunting parties in initiation.
Initiation?
I have to duke it out with him? Vida asked petulantly. I thought you said it was going to be a fight.
Knox laughed, and once Knox laughed, everyone was laughing too.
Honestly, Vida said, whipping her mass of blue hair back over her shoulder, you might as well let him go. He's totally worthless. I'll have him laid out on the ground in 3 seconds. Just saying.
Jude wore his confusion plainly, not understanding that this was her warped way of trying to protect Chubbs from a fight he'd never win. I was surprised she cared enough to try.
She's not lying, I said. If you want the better fighter, it's her, hands down. But he's trained in first aid. He's patched me up more than once. Look.
I lifted my hair away from the scar on my forehead. Knox didn't take the bait to examine it closer. He wove his fingers together and rested them on the back of his neck as he seemed to mull this over.
The question is more what we're going to do with you and the yellow.
I did not like the direction this conversation was heading, and neither did Jude. I felt him start to shake, just a little bit, and I closed one hand over his wrist.
We don't take on weak ones, Knox said. This isn't a pity parade or a homeless shelter. I'm not about to waste food on a green or a yellow. No one here can vouch for you, which means you'll have to prove yourself in other ways.
Chubbs turned on him, his fists clenched at his sides, but another voice rose up before his had the chance to. It was small, more timid than I remembered, but I recognized it.
I can vouch for them.
At East River, Clancy had relied on 2 different kids to run security for the camp. Hayes, the ogre-sized brute who ran hits for supplies, and Olivia, who coordinated watch at the perimeters of the camp. Tusser was relieved to see a head of long, honey-blonde hair push its way through the crowd was an understatement. But her face? I recognized the pieces of her, but it was like they had been torn apart and reassembled with a careless hand. She limped, badly, as she moved closer to us. Yes, this was Olivia, but at the same time, it wasn't. Her round cheeks, always flushed with the run she had taken or the orders she had barked out, had sunk in so deeply that it made her eyes look owlish. The golden tan that had kissed her skin was faded to dull ash, and as she turned to look at me, a bolt of horror raced from my heart to the pit of my stomach. Almost the entire right side of her face was puckered with pink scar tissue. It dragged down the corner of that eye, ran down her jawline. It looked as though she'd been mauled by a wild animal or slapped with a fistful of flames.
"Olivia!" I gasped. "Oh, my God!"
How? No, I knew that she had escaped. Liam had told us as much. When the fires and PSFs came to East River, a few of the watch kids had been lucky enough to get away in time, Olivia included. Liam was the only one who had come back to look for us.
"Christ,"
Chubb said, automatically taking a step toward her.
"You..."
"The four of them were with me when we escaped the PSF van that had rounded us up," Olivia said, ignoring the hand Chubbs raised in her direction. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw the boy in the green coat push himself off the door and through the crowd, stopping near Knox's side.
"We got separated in the escape through the woods."
The Olivia I had known had been so full of fire, she could have brought the entire warehouse down to a pile of simpering ash. Now, she merely bobbed her head with a meekness that didn't suit her at all.
"Ruby is the one who planned the escape, sir."
"Oh, yeah,"
said the boy in the green coat. He stuffed his hands in his pockets, rocking back on his heels.
"I thought they looked familiar. A couple kids gave us a slip that day."
Olivia's gaze flickered toward his, her brows creased in what was either surprise or confusion. It certainly wasn't gratitude on her face.
"Really?"
Knox's voice was still flat, but I felt his eyes drift back over to me.
"And you spent the last few months just wandering around my fine state?"
"Laying low, gathering supplies, looking for Olivia," I said quickly, risking a glance to the boy. What was he playing at?
"Why didn't you mention this to Michael, Brett?" Knox asked. "Or speak up before?"
The boy, Brett, shrugged.
"Didn't make the connection till now, I guess. Her hair was shorter." He nodded toward me. "And the other one was dressed different."
"They can help me,"
Olivia continued, her eyes still on the ground. "At least until they prove themselves to you." Knox blew out an exasperated sigh. He began to pace again, each step falling like thunder in the silence of the warehouse. There was almost a little skip to his step as he walked.
"Fine," he said, looking up. "Take the yellow and green. Charles, too."
And just like that, he was out of my reach. I was useless to get us out of there.
"The hot piece will stay and keep us entertained," Knox said, smoothing his hair behind his ears with a grin.
He nodded to the boys at his left.
"Strip their jackets. Take anything valuable they might still have on them, and keep them outside, where the trash belongs."
14. The side door of the warehouse led into an extensive parking lot. The sea of black was broken up by a few sullen-looking tents, all near to collapsing under the pockets of water collecting on them. Wood pallets formed a kind of floating platform for each one and connected them in a crooked loop. I saw right away why they were needed. They lifted us those few precious inches out of the murky water that swamped the whole lot. Smoke drifted up lazily from the smoldering remains of fires, mingling with the sour smell of old water. I crossed my arms over my chest, feeling the last bit of anger and despair at the loss of Liam's jacket shake off me. At the far left end of the lot were two small gray buildings, one of which Michael and his team were streaming out of, clutching armfuls of bread and chips. They crossed paths with Brett on their way back to the warehouse, slapping his shoulder, trying to turn him back. He simply waved them on and kept walking toward the building they had come from, and the one next to it, marked with a spray-painted red X over the door. Judging by the locks on the door, no one came out and no one went in. Olivia waited until the hunters ducked back into the warehouse before she turned sharp on her heels and gripped my shoulders.
"Oh my God,"
she was saying, her voice shaking madly.
"Not you, too. He's..."
"What happened?" I whispered. Chubbs was there in an instant, looping one of Olivia's arms over his shoulder. "What the hell is going on?"
"Wait, you actually do know each other?"
Jude cried. Chubbs yanked him forward, pulling him into our huddle.
"After I left East River, I was... well?"
There was no small amount of fury tucked into her words.
"I found a car with a few of the others, and we got all the way to Tennessee."
I nodded, waiting for her to continue.
"Of course, the car gave out. The PSFs were on us the entire time, and we didn't really have a choice. We split up and ran. I took to the woods and got pulled in by one of the slip kids' hunting parties."
"But I thought Fancy was the slip kid."
Jude wrapped his arms around himself in a vain attempt to stay warm. I elbowed him, hard.
"Fancy?"
Olivia asked, startled. "He nicknamed Clancy," I said, blowing out a long sigh. The slightest smile curled her lips, only to be replaced by a burst of intense, dark pain. Her hand floated up to her neck and pressed hard at her collarbone, as if she were trying to keep something in by force.
"You know what happened, right?"
I whispered.
"You know he was responsible."
She nodded.
"I didn't want to believe it at first, but that night when you guys tried to leave, I could see the way he had manipulated us, controlled us. Our security system was near perfect, and we always knew Gray would leave Clancy alone rather than risk exposing him. The only way they could have found us was if someone leaked the coordinates or provoked him, and the only one with a way to do that was...
She slid her hand up the length of her throat, hiding the tremor there. Before, at East River, I'd only had a kind of passing acquaintance with Olivia. Most of our interactions were colored by whether or not Clancy or Liam were around. If they weren't there, we barely acknowledged each other. She had been invested in both in different ways. Liam was someone who had been easy to work with, who challenged her to think about what they could do for the camps instead of just biding their time deep in the woods. But Clancy? Clancy had been the one she had wanted to protect, impress. Like every other kid at that camp, he had been her savior, her everything.
"Fancy sort of suits him,"
she said finally, stepping out of my grip. We made our way carefully over the pallets, walking along the swaying trail of them.
"When their hunting party found me, I only went with them willingly because I wanted to get to Clancy,"
Olivia muttered.
"I wasn't even thinking it was strange he could set up another camp so fast, or that he had gotten away at all. I just wanted to ask him why he did that to us. I think I would have killed him."
"A totally reasonable response," Chubbs assured her. "Even more reasonable if you had done it slowly, with much fire and ice picks." Somehow, Olivia didn't find that funny.
"Imagine my surprise when they dragged me in front of that hick," she said. "The very first thing he told me was that the only way I'd get out of his tribe was if they decided to dump my body in the river."
I shook my head, trying to dispel the angry buzzing between my ears and focus on the here and now, rather than what I was going to do to the bastard. "What's his story?"
"Knox's?"
Olivia glanced around, but we were alone.
"I can't get a straight one. Supposedly he broke out of PSF custody a few years back and was holed up in different parts of Nashville until the flood. I don't know how he convinced the first kids here to join up, but I can tell you that most of us didn't join the tribe by choice."
Jude's thick eyebrows were drawn together. Why does he hate the other colors so much? What happened?
Olivia lifted a shoulder.
Who knows? No one's willing to risk his anger by asking. We already have to fight for every scrap of food as it is.
I was wondering about that. It seems like he doesn't even treat the blues he has here all that well, I said. Are they staying because they're scared?
She nodded to the trees at the other end of the parking lot, past the tents.
If you were to try to make a run for it, you'd run into the patrol he set up. And if you run into the patrol, you don't come back. It's already hard enough that he takes everything you own and forces you to earn it back. But if you don't work hard enough or suck up enough or entertain him, you get sent out here. Or you get traded.
Traded?
Olivia was as close to tears as I had ever seen her.
That's how he gets food. You saw the blockades around the city, right? All the soldiers? He brings in the kids he considers worthless, and he trades them for smokes and food. Only now they've been asking for more kids and giving him less and less stuff to balance it out. I'm surprised they haven't just raided us, but I guess he's managed to keep this place a secret.
I thought she was the one trembling until I looked down at my own hands. Olivia bit her lip.
And, of course, he takes the kids in the white tent, the ones no one would know to miss. He knows I can't do anything about it, and that they can't fight back. The one time I tried, he took two kids out instead of one.
What about that kid, Brett? I asked. He stood up for you.
It doesn't work that way, Olivia said. He's different than Michael, but Michael's second in command. Brett might bring me things for the kids here every once in a while, but if Michael were to catch him, he'd be the next one gone.
The white tent was exactly that, a large, crooked tent strung together with stained white tarp set off from the others. The stench of it reached us almost before the sight of it did. Olivia lifted the red bandana hanging around her neck to cover her mouth. The air was heavy, so thick with the stench of human waste that breathing became almost impossible.
You just have to take him and get out while he still has a chance, Olivia was saying. As long as your friend is in the warehouse, you won't be able to get to her. But you can take him, at least. I can help you. You might be able to overpower the patrol together.
Jude's hand clenched around my upper arm. It's okay, I told him. It's not an option. We won't leave her behind. He nodded, his face pinched with worry as he glanced back over his shoulder to the warehouse.
Are they going to hurt her?
I raised an eyebrow. I'm a lot more worried about what she could do to them. Olivia, Chubbs called softly. Are you okay? She had stopped just outside of the tent, her hands bunching up the fabric. She bowed her head forward, resting it against the flap.
I'm sorry, I tried. I've tried so hard, but...
Olivia's voice was anguished.
I'm the only one who will help them. He tried for a while, but...
He? I repeated, feeling my heart go very still.
Who?
Olivia blinked, her confusion marred by the scars on her face.
Aren't you... You aren't here for Liam?
I don't remember pushing past her, but I do remember my hands, as pale as the fabric of the large tent, shoving aside the old bedsheet serving as the door. The stench intensified inside, combined with the sickening scent of mold and foul water. I blinked, forcing my eyes to adjust to the low light. The pallets underfoot creaked and groaned as I stepped inside, one snapping altogether. There were so many of them. At least 25 kids in rows on either side of the tent. Some were curled up on their sides, others tangled up in the thin sheets around them. And there was Liam, right in the center of them all. I lied before. To Kate, to the others. To myself. Every day,
every single day. Because here was the truth. Here it was, tearing up and out of me, drawing my feet toward the far corner of the tent, rising like a whimper. I regretted it. Seeing his face now, the way his cracked and bruised hands curled softly around the pale yellow blanket draped over him, I regretted it so much, with such a sharp ache, that I felt myself begin to double over before I had taken a single step toward him. For months, his face had lived only on computer screens, his scowl captured forever in digital files. It was locked in my memory, but I knew firsthand how memories warp and fade as time passes. It was so selfish of me, so terrible and sick. But for 3 long heartbeats, all I could think was, I should have kept him with me. I missed him. I missed him. I missed him. Oh my God, I missed him so much. The tent was still and so quiet around us. I brushed a finger against the edge of his blanket's pilling fabric. Someone had stripped him down to a gray t-shirt. His bare feet stuck out toward me, pale, tinged the faintest blue. I felt my breath go out of me in a single blow. The last time I had seen him, his face had been mottled with bruises and cuts, courtesy of one bad escape attempt from East River. But this was the face I remembered. The one I had seen that first day in the minivan. The one that could never hide a single thought. My eyes drifted aimlessly from his broad, clear brow, along the edge of his strong, unshaved jaw. That full bottom lip, chapped and cracked from the cold. His hair matted and darker, too long even for him. The air that filled his chest went out in a terrible, wheezing rattle. I reached out, trying to stop my hand from shaking as it settled against his chest. I wanted to count the space between breaths, reassure myself the shallow movement was still movement. It was only a faint touch, but his eyes blinked open. The sky blue had taken on a glassy quality, fever bright against his otherwise dirty face. They drifted shut again, and I could have sworn the edges of his lips curled up in a faint smile. If a heart could break once, it shouldn't have been able to happen again. But here I was, and here he was, and it was all so much more terrible than I ever could have imagined. "Lee," I said, pressing my hand against his chest again, harder. I brought my other hand to his cheek. That was what I was afraid of. They weren't red from the biting cold. He was hot to the touch. "Liam, open your eyes."
"There," he mumbled, shifting under his blankets. "There you are. Can you... the keys are... I left them there."
"There you are." I stiffened, but didn't move my hand. "Lee," I said again, "can you hear me? Can you understand what I'm saying?" His eyelids fluttered open.
"Just Nita."
The pallet creaked as Chubbs knelt beside me.
"Hey, buddy,"
he said, his breath hitching in his throat as he reached over to place the back of his hand against Liam's forehead.
"This is some mess you've walked your idiotic self into."
Liam's eyes drifted over to him. The tension in his face seemed to drip away, replaced by a goofy expression of pure joy.
"Chubbsicle?"
"Yeah, yeah, wipe that dumbass look off your face," Chubbs said, despite the fact he was wearing an identical look on his own.
Liam's brow wrinkled.
"What? But your folks?"
Chubbs glanced over at me.
"Can you help me sit him up?"
We each took an arm and tugged his dead weight into an upright position. Liam's head lolled back, his head falling into that curve between my shoulder and neck. My fingers skimmed the lines of his ribs, catching on the bones. He was so thin. I pressed my fingers to the knobs of his spine and tried very, very hard not to cry. Chubbs pressed his ear up against Liam's chest.
Take a deep breath and blow it out.
Liam's right hand flopped over, giving his friend's face a few clumsy, affectionate pats.
Love you, too.
Breathe, Chubbs repeated, long and deep. It wasn't long, and it wasn't deep, but I saw his white breath fan out. Sitting back, Chubbs straightened his glasses and motioned for me to help ease him back down. I thought I heard him mumble,
"Here?"
But Chubbs nudged me out of the way to pick up his wrist and count off his pulse.
"How long has he been like this?"
Chubbs asked. It was the first time I found myself able to look away from Liam's face. Olivia was hovering behind us, her face splotchy from her scars and the freezing cold. Jude was frozen in the doorway, mouth open in a look of total and complete horror.
"He was caught about a week and a half ago, and he had a really nasty bug he couldn't shake," Olivia explained, her voice trembling slightly. "I knew something was wrong right away. I kept asking him questions about you guys, and he just seemed so disoriented. It turned into a fever, and then this."
"What's wrong with him?" Jude asked. "Why is he acting like that?"
As if to answer for himself, Liam suddenly twisted to the side, his face screwing up with the effort it took to cough. Deep, wet coughs that shook his entire frame and left him gasping for air. I kept one hand on his stomach, reassured by the slow pulse I felt there.
God, his face.
My eyes returned to it over and over again.
"I think he has pneumonia," Chubbs said. "I can't be sure, but it seems the most likely. If I had to guess, most of the kids here have it, too."
He stood on unsteady legs.
"What are you treating them with?"
From the moment we had entered the tent until now, my shock and horror at the sight of Liam had been enough to make me forget even my anger. But the bitter reality was solidifying around me, and I could feel the heat rising in my chest, twisting and twisting and twisting until it felt like the next breath I released was tinged with fire. Olivia's words spilled over one another.
"Nothing. There's nothing. I have to beg for food. We're surrounded by water. We are drowning in water, and I can't even get a drop of the fresh stuff."
"It's okay," he told her. "Liv, it's okay. I know you're trying."
"Do you have anything in the car?"
I asked, looking up at Chubbs.
"Nothing strong enough for this," he said. "We need to get them warm, dry, and hydrated before anything else."
Olivia was still shaking her head.
"I've tried so many times, but he won't move the sick ones into the warehouse. Most of them aren't blues, and they only got this bad because he refused to give them work. And if you don't work, you don't get food. You can't come into the warehouse. I honestly think he's trying to hide them from the others."
"Well, he couldn't hide them from me. He couldn't hide what he had done to Liam." I felt a pure, unflinching fury grip me. I couldn't have shaken it, even if I had wanted to. I was on my feet, storming toward the flap, and there was only one thought in my mind, streaming through again and again, driving the anger deeper until I felt like I would explode with it.
"Where are you going?"
Jude asked, stepping in my way. "Ruby?"
"I'm going to take care of this."
It was a stranger's voice, calm, certain.
"Absolutely not," Chubbs said. "What happens if someone catches you swaying him? What do you think he'll do to you?"
"Sway him? Like the way Clancy would have?"
Olivia asked. Her eyes went a touch wider at my nod.
"Oh, I wondered why he was so interested in you. Why he fought so hard to keep you from leaving."
"Jude," I said, "help Chubbs. You guys need to figure out if there's a way to get a fire going in here without burning the place down. You remember how to do that, right?" He nodded, his expression still screwed up in misery.
"You have to do something. We have to stop him. Make him see this isn't right. Please."
"Ruby?" Olivia called. Her voice was clear, each word cut from stone.
"Ruin him."
My mind was buzzing, waking from a long, unwelcome sleep. It had been a while, hadn't it? My right fist clenched at my side, as if each finger was imagining how it would feel wrapped around his throat. It would be easy. All I needed to do was get close to him. I knew it was what Clancy would have done. He thought it was our right to use our abilities, that we had been given them for a reason. "We have to use them," he had said, "to keep the others in their place." The silky quality of his voice slipped through me, a shudder following like an echo. His dark eyes had been wild when he said that, burning with conviction. I had been terrified of him then, at what he could do, and how easily. I had those abilities too. For whatever reason, whatever science was locked away on Leda Corp's servers, I had a way to right almost every wrong Knox had brought upon these kids. And Jude? He had turned to me without hesitation, with full faith, like it was the most natural thing for me to take care of this. I was beginning to see how it was. Ruin him. I'd do more than that. I was going to humiliate him, bring him low, leave him an empty shell whose only memory was my face. I would chase him into sleep. I would make him regret the moment he'd decided to keep Liam here and leave him outside to die. "Be careful," Jude whispered, stepping aside to let me pass. "Don't worry about me," I said. "See if you can find a black coat around here. Check his pockets to make sure he didn't find the flash drive and take it out, too." "Later, Gator," he said. "In an hour, Sunflower," I murmured. I could feel Chubbs's eyes on my back, but I didn't turn around. I couldn't. Not without the fear that I'd be forever frozen in this exact spot, watching Liam waste away into nothing in front of me. "I am here," I thought as I stepped out into the rain. "He is here. We are all here. And we would be leaving together. Today." 15. The boy guarding the door into the warehouse couldn't have been older than me, but he did stand a good deal taller and wider. A few months ago, that would have been a real obstacle.
"Stay where you are," he called out, watching me stalk toward him. "You're not allowed inside no more. Not until Knox says so."
They had given him a gun, but I could tell by his grip he either didn't know how to use it or he didn't want to. I reached out and brushed my fingers against his outstretched hand. I stopped the memories before they could bubble up. Anger made my abilities sharper somehow, more efficient. "Sit down and stay down," I snapped, and I shoved the door open. Our combat instructor had once told us that, when you were trying to settle a dispute without violence, the least productive emotion you could give into was anger. No one can reason with another person so furious she can barely see straight. Well, I thought it was pretty productive to getting my way. I let the wind slam the door shut behind me. I stood in the dark, blinking to adjust my eyes to the light. I felt a movement at my side. A solid, thick shoulder appeared directly in front of me, blocking both my path and line of sight. I followed the line of green coat up to Brett's grim face. "You can't be here," he whispered. I felt him try to press something into my hands and glanced down. He'd taken his hat off and stuffed it with tiny packages of saltine crackers. "Take this and go back before he sees..." I had just wrapped my fingers around his wrist when the eyes up on the platform finally picked me out of the shadowy crowd.
"Well, well, well," Knox called. "Look what the wind went and blew in."
I glanced around, surprised to find nearly twice as many kids scattered around the space as before. Most were up near the platform, seated on the ground in circles with bags of chips and cereal boxes out in front of them. They were dressed in shades of gray and white. Hunters back from their hunting? The boys and girls at the far end of the warehouse were stretched out on the cement, moving just enough for me to see that they were breathing. I didn't see any food or fire near them. I forced a deep breath in, relaxing my face into a fake smile. I had to work this slower, get him to drop his guard so I could get closer. Every nerve in my body was screaming for me to move, run, grab him. My heart throbbed with the refrain, "Now, now, now." But there were too many bodies between us,
too many hands with guns. Knox leaned forward in his chair.
Something you want to say?
I noticed Vida then, her shock of electric blue hair shining over his shoulder. She moved carefully, long limbs graceful, as she swerved and slid through the bodies on the stage. The look on her face told me everything I needed to know. If Knox made the mistake of leaning back in his chair just then, she would have gladly found a way to break his neck. Okay? I mouthed to her. Vida nodded, her eyes flicking down to Knox, then back at me. I knew what she was telling me to do. Michael stood from where he'd been pawing at some poor, shaking girl's chest, and he blocked Vida from my sight again.
I was just wondering what it would take to convince you to let me go out on hunts, I said.
I slipped my frozen hands into the back pockets of my pants as I walked up to the stage.
To let me go out and get supplies for everyone?
Knox threw his head back and laughed. Several of the girls and younger boys sitting on the platform around his feet forced out breathy laughter of their own. My skin prickled. It sounded like a pack of dogs with sliced vocal cords was trying to bark. I felt a body move behind me, coming up at my back, but I didn't turn to see who it was. These kids weren't about to force me out through intimidation. Michael could hit me, Brett could haul me back outside by force, but what I could do to them went beyond the physical.
You? Michael scoffed. A green?
What's the matter? I asked. Don't tell me you're afraid I'll prove there's nothing special about you blues after all. I've always heard you guys were all brawn, no brain. Just like I thought, he definitely wasn't used to being spoken to this way. The bully in him was fascinated and very, very angry all at once. Most likely because everyone around us looked like they were starting to wonder why I couldn't go out and get them the supplies they obviously needed. Knox stood slowly, tapping the ash from his cigarette out on the ground. Come here, I thought. Come here and let me end this. The trickle began at the back of my mind, turning to a full-on roar. I could do this. One step closer, and I'd show him why they ranked my kind as orange, and his only as blue. I would tear him down. Knox's hair slid forward, past his ears. When he pushed it back, I saw he had woven together bright pieces of paper into rings around each finger. They almost looked like the project a bored kid would make with a candy wrapper. I didn't know what the hell they were or why he was wearing them, but it gave me an idea.
How about a trade? I asked.
No work, no food, right? You let me join one of those hunting teams so I can eat, and I provide enough food to feed everyone for the winter. Knox scoffed, rolling his eyes.
I'm not lying, I said. You saw what we had in our packs. That's just what we could fit in our bags. We had to leave tons of it behind.
Vida's full, petal-pink lips parted, a silent question dripping from them. Of course I was lying. She knew that. Come on, I thought. He'd have to accept. I could feel the mood of the kids around us shifting in eagerness. They watched me with a new light in their eyes. There was canned food, walls of it, and gallons of clean water. Toilet paper, even, I added, because, let's face it, there are some things you want but don't necessarily need.
Clothes, blankets, you name it. You could stock this place nicely.
By the time I finished speaking, it was so silent I could hear the plink, plink, plink of water dripping from a nearby leak in the roof.
Oh, yeah? And where is this wonderland? Half past nowhere, straight on into your imagination?
Knox was pacing across the stage again, still blocked by the kids sitting at the edge of it. If he didn't bite soon, I was going to have to jump up there myself.
Why would I tell you, I asked, when you won't give me what I want?
That was how relationships worked these days. No one did anything for each other unless it benefited them in some way. Knox had clearly seen enough of the world we lived in to have figured this out, too. But he didn't like it.
Come on, I thought, fuming. Come on.
With one jump, he was off the platform, and I was shoved back by an invisible set of hands onto the cement.
My teeth clacked against each other, and I just missed losing the tip of my tongue between them. Michael's laughter boomed around me, like it was echoing off the timid, silent figures circling us.
"You think I need to trade you something?" Knox spat. "You think I don't have other ways of making you and your friends talk?"
My hands pressed flat against the ground, wrists throbbing from the impact. This kid had more pride than greed, something I hadn't expected. He didn't even see that more food and supplies at his disposal meant more power for him. All he saw was a little girl who claimed to know better than him, who was giving him a solution to a problem he had created, and stirring up unwanted questions in the kids around him. Even if the kids didn't believe me, they wanted to.
"Sure you do," came Vida's voice. "But are you willing to risk waiting when the National Guard is going to be back to clear the joint out?"
She had made herself comfortable in Knox's seat, to the visible horror of every kid nearby. Michael whirled back around, fury rising from his shoulders like steam.
"Knox! You gonna take that from her?" "Don't tell me you're scared of a few little soldiers," Vida continued, inspecting her broken fingernails. "Is that why you keep trying to prove her wrong? Because you're scared of what'll happen if she's right?"
"Come on," came Brett's voice somewhere near my right. "You have to admit, it sounds too good to be true. We've been up and down the river a million times looking for food and never found so much as an empty bag of chips."
"So you'd blow an opportunity like this?" I asked, "after you already saw the proof?" For his rough exterior, Brett was surprisingly reasonable when it came to hashing things out.
"I could go with her, make sure she's not trying to pull a fast one. I'd be happy to take another trip back with the team and get the supplies."
"Oh, you could?" Michael snarled. "You'd be happy to? Whose team are you talking about? Mine? You think I don't know what you're trying to pull, dickhead? That I haven't been watching your weak-ass attempts to steal my game?"
Knox held up a hand, stopping them before they could start circling each other like starving feral cats.
"The answer is no. Not now, not ever."
"I should have known," I said, pushing myself onto my feet. "You left those kids out in the freezing cold to die. Why would you ever care enough to give everyone here the food and supplies they need? You can push someone's button over and over again to get what you want, but there comes a point when your finger slips and you finally hit the wrong one."
"Michael,"
Knox murmured, suddenly very quiet. Vida had worked enough of a spell over the room that it took calling his name twice to get him to snap out of it.
"Take these two pearls of girls outside."
"Knox," Brett began, "what about the supplies?"
Knox's fist flew out fast, clipping the other boy under the chin.
"Take them outside. If they're so damn eager to be hunters, then they can prove it at initiation tonight, like everyone else had to."
Vida pushed herself up off the chair and dropped onto the floor next to Knox. Whether he meant to or not, his eyes flicked down over her face and body, over every exposed inch of rich, dark skin.
"If you get through it, you're on. But if I see your faces one more time before I send someone to get you, I will burn them off myself."
"Shake on it," I demanded, fighting to keep the smirk off my face. I stuck out my hand, my head trilling with anticipation of how it would feel, of what, exactly, I would do to bring him as low as he had brought everyone around him. Knox came toward me, his face steeled, jaw clenched. He raised a hand toward mine, and just when his fingers came into reach, he shifted to grab the ends of my loose braid. It came down to him being just a second faster than my instincts. He pressed the burning red end of his cigarette into my palm, snuffing it out against my skin before shoving me away. The pain was raw and blinding. I didn't cry, didn't so much as give him a gasp. But I knew, from the moment he glanced back over his shoulder at me with that smirk, I hadn't gotten my hooks into him either. They brought us around to the other side of the warehouse, out of sight from the tents and door, to a caged-in area where dead power generators and AC units were locked up. Vida took one look at our future habitat and began to kick and snarl, struggling against the two guys holding her. With one ear-splitting shriek from her, they lifted Vida into the air and tossed her in. I was in such a state of blind pain, all it took was a nudge from the guy holding my arm for me to walk into the chain-link cage. I waited until they had secured the locks and were making their way back to the building before dropping to my knees. I pressed my blistered palm into a puddle of freezing slush, swallowing back the whimper. The burn had sliced through every other thought in my head. Next to me, Vida pushed herself up, dragging her legs over so she could lean against the fence. She took a deep breath in, closing her eyes.
"Let me guess," she said after she had steadied herself. "You found Prince Charming in the white tent."
"Him and about 20 others," I said, hating the way my voice shook. My entire hand felt like it was on fire. I tried shaking it out, but the burn felt like it was tearing its way down through each layer of skin.
"Show me,"
Vida said. When I didn't flip my palm up, she did it for me. I was surprised to feel her vibrating with her own kind of rage.
"Damn, I'll kill him."
She carefully placed my hand palm down in the slush again. "I blew it," I said. "I was right there. He was right there. I should have just used my other hand or..."
"Bitch, please," she said. "If you had been able to recover fast enough to do something, then you really wouldn't be human."
"As opposed to what?" She shrugged.
"A mannequin? An unfeeling, heartless bitch who feeds on others' misery and is physically incapable of crying unless it's tears of blood?"
I flexed my good hand in my lap. "Is that my rep at HQ?"
"They call you Medusa," Vida said. "One wrong look and your brain turns to stone."
"Creative. Also fitting."
"Where are the others?" she asked.
"In the white tent outside," I said. I sat back against the steel AC unit so I could look at Vida. "They're all really, really sick. Half of them look like they're already dead."
"They're that bad?" she asked. "Stuart, too?"
"Yeah."
"Damn," she muttered. "That explains why you looked so pissed."
"Yeah," I said, feeling my anger start to prickle again. I'd had him. He was right there. And I had been too stupid and too slow to end it.
"It does." "Hey, Boo," she said. "I'm in this now, too, and I got a lot of experience playing assholes like they're fucking harps. You need backup? I got you. Stop trying to convince yourself that you're in this alone."
I looked up, surprised.
"But just so you know," she said, sounding like herself again, "if it turns out that we have to fight each other for this initiation shit, I'm still going to kick your ass."